Feral Audio.
Hello, pals. It's me, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Hare Krishna. I love that song. That song just makes you want to stick a heroin needle in your neck and stare at a lava lamp until a gargoyle carries you out of your apartment and into a cave. Beautiful song, Don't Fear the Reaper by the Blue Oyster Cult. And I love the song. I'm not sure that the song is necessarily a Buddhist message. I think it really is more about a vampire that flies off with a girl, but I'm not positive about that. As a side note, it's also the name of a candy that an entrepreneurial elementary school kid who used to ride my school bus would sell in the morning. I don't know where he got it from, but the candy itself seemed sinister, I guess because the name Cult was in it. But it was called Blue Oyster Cult. I think it was called Blue Oyster Cult, and it tasted like lemons. Had nothing to do with a band or a cult. Regardless, that song contains within it what I think is the essence of the advice you guys gave me after my last episode, where I talked about how I was terrified over getting these chest x-rays and a blood test, which is what I have to do as part of this protocol I have to follow since I had testicular cancer. And I am not good at waiting for results from medical tests. In fact, I freak out. I have severe anxiety attacks. No matter what I do, just thinking about the statistics, it doesn't help. Like, I can think about how there is only a 6% chance that there will be a recurrence of the sort of cancer that I had, and that just doesn't help. Trying to assuage fear with statistics is like throwing matchsticks at Godzilla. It doesn't work. I just get overcome by this sort of tsunami of inner terror, a black wave, a chilling black wave just washes over me when I consider the phone call from the doctor or the doctor's appointment. So that was what I was going through, and I didn't expect to get such an amazing response from you guys when I asked for advice, but what I ended up getting was not just really good advice in how to deal with anxiety when you're waiting for medical results or when you're dealing with a medical problem, but also so many stories about what you all are going through. And some of you guys are going through things that make getting chest x-rays and a blood test seem like a nice day barbecuing at the beach with your pals. Something about sharing your problems or opening up about stuff you're afraid of and then hearing what other people are afraid of, it eases the terror in some way, and it helps you know that you're not alone. I want to figure out a way to connect everyone who sent me an email with each other, but I don't know how to do that without massively invading your privacy, because I'm sure some of you who sent me emails have no interest in being part of a group or a forum or a group of people talking to each other, but I just feel selfish being the only person who gets this kind of support, and you all deserve it too. So I don't know, maybe I'll talk with Steve, figure out a way to create a Google group or get all those emails together in some place where you guys can all talk to each other, because you helped me tremendously. As it turns out, I had nothing to be afraid of. Everything's fine. I went to see my doctor. He says the tests were perfect and that I'm fine. So I don't have to worry about any more tests until June, when I have to get another CT scan. And then after that, I only have to get tests once a year. So it's a relief. But just because I'm getting through this current little catastrophe that happened in my life doesn't mean that there won't be another one. And for a lot of you guys, you're still going through your personal struggles right now. And so I wanted to play for you a clip from a Jack Kornfield lecture that I'm listening to that I downloaded from Audible, which addresses the idea of facing our fear in a graceful way. This is from Jack Kornfield's audiobook, Awakening is Real, A Guide to the Deeper Dimensions of the Inner Journey. And you can get this on Audible, and I'm sure that it's on Amazon too and a lot of other places. So, Awakening is Real, A Guide to the Deeper Dimensions of the Inner Journey by Jack Kornfield.
This from Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winner. He said, suffering confers neither privileges nor rights. It all depends on how you use it. If you use it to increase the anguish of yourself or others, you are degrading, even betraying it. And yet the day will come when we shall understand that suffering can also elevate human beings. God help us to bear our suffering well. So that really speaks about taking the difficulties of one's life, whether it's the spiritual path or, well, there isn't really anything else, frankly. It's the spiritual path or nothing, basically, because that's what your difficulties are. I mean, you know the old kind of trite saying, you're not a human being having spiritual experiences, you're a spiritual being having human experiences and using them to remember who we are. So sometimes it happens in an accidental way, but in meditation, one deliberately turns toward difficulty or turns toward the measure of suffering that we're given in life and says, all right, let me find something that's greater in this heart and mind through which I can understand and live wisely. There's a passage in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha says, and so I reflected, perhaps I should face my fear. This is the Buddha before he was enlightened. Maybe I should seek out those dark groves, the deepest and wildest parts of the forest, or the charnel grounds and funeral grounds on the new moon of the month where no light shines, and go out there in the places most feared by humans and sit or stand in such a place and not move while all the wild sounds of the forests and the winds and the animals are heard around me, and not move until I had faced my fear absolutely and fully and conquered it. So that was the Buddha's little trip into that, and he did.
Face your fear. Go into the shadows. We don't have fields of dead bodies that we can sit around these days, and if you do have one, you should call the police immediately. And there's no if you want to get eaten by a wild animal these days, you actually have to work at it. You used to be able to just stand outside of your hut and a wolf would come out of the forest and drag you away. But these days, the wolves and the graveyards, they live in our minds. And I love the idea of transforming them into teachers. I love the idea. I'm not very good at executing the idea. In fact, this stuff, as much as I love to talk about it and play clips from it, it's really hard for me to use it. And when I was waiting for these test results and just in a deep state of anxiety, nothing helped, really. Nothing helped. But the cool thing about Buddhism and the cool thing about meditation is that it's not something that you're in a rush. It's not something that you can rush. It's just a tool that you can have in the toolbox for the inevitable time when you find yourself in the graveyards and dark parts of the forest of modern life. So hopefully that helps. Jack Kornfield's fantastic. For those of you who are going through the heavy shit right now, I highly recommend that audiobook. You can find out more about him by going to jackkornfield.com. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Squarespace is a company where you can finally bring your idea for an award-winning website into existence. You don't have to learn to code anymore. You don't have to snort Adderall until 4 a.m. and rub cocaine into your gums so that you can digest some brand new technological language that will allow you to build a website. Don't do it. Coding can drive you insane. Literally, you can lose your mind from having to deal with formatting HTML and ActionScript and God knows what. I learned to code 4 years ago. I learned how to code in ActionScript, and the way I did it was by taking amphetamines. I took speed that one of my friends gave me for like 3 days straight and went into a deep coding trance. It was blissful and demonic. I felt like I was staring into the Necronomicon. I felt like at any moment some dark digital demon could come clambering out of my computer screen and rip my eyeballs out and fly off to some dark peak and throw them over the edge. It wasn't fun. And this dangerous, dark path of coding is why so many web designers have completely lost their minds, and why when you run into them, if you turn your back on them for just a second, you can see their eyes look up into the sky. You can see their eyes dilate, and they'll begin to mutter weird strings of code as some kind of prayer. They lose their minds. They become characters in H.P. Lovecraft's story. And for those of you who are web designers and write to complain about the fact that from time to time I jab at you guys during these Squarespace commercials, I'm not talking about you. There are a lot of great web designers out there. I use one. His name's Stee. He's amazing. He's the guy who designed my website. His company's called Chromadial. He's a great person and an excellent web designer. But not everyone on this planet can afford a web designer right away. Sometimes you want to just dip your toe into the digital water and find out if that business selling journals made of grandmother flesh is going to be profitable before you go and get a supremely advanced website. Squarespace.com, it's there for you. Plans start at $8.99 a month. If you sign up, they give you a free domain name. They've got everything you need to make a professional website, from a blog to a podcast website to a shopping cart so that you can sell stuff. It's all there. They've got a great customer service department. I tested it out to make sure that they were accessible and available, and they get back to you right away. So, and you need that. Even though Squarespace is easy to use, it's still building a website, which can be a little complicated, and sometimes you need an expert to guide you along through the design process. So go to squarespace.com, $9 a month starting off. If you put in the code Duncan, you will get 10% off the website. And there's also a 15-day trial period, so you can check them out to make sure that they're what you want to use. We're also brought to you by SureDesignT-Shirts.com. Now, if you're like me, then you have unicorn soft, sensitive skin. Your skin is more sensitive than the vulva of a newborn unicorn. It's so sensitive that if you wear regular t-shirts, your skin reacts in the same way that the skin of a satanic child reacts when doused in holy water. You erupt in boils and spray a combination of blood and pus and sweat out into the world. You actually turn into a satanic sprinkler, just spraying death all around you. If I wear a regular cotton t-shirt, then I actually have to go to the hospital for 2 weeks to deal with the severe boils and diseases that break out all over my body because my skin is so special and so, so very soft. But thanks to Sure Design t-shirts, I don't have to worry about going to the hospital every time I accidentally put on a friend's shirt. I get to enjoy the blissful experience. It feels like you're being embraced by the wings of a gargoyle. Yes. Yes, I think this is the second time I've talked about gargoyles in this podcast, which is weird. Don't know why my mind keeps going to the gargs, but maybe it's because I just found out that gargoyles are very sensitive, loving creatures that have been completely misunderstood, and they are great at giving hugs because their wings are so very soft and because they're so lonely because they've been rejected for so long. Sure Design t-shirts figured this out a long time ago, and what they did is they started luring lonely gargoyles into their t-shirt company using ads on Craigslist. Swarms of lonely gargoyles descend on the Sure Design t-shirts manufacturing plant in Thailand, thinking that they're going to find a soulmate or someone to love them. In fact, what they find is a grinder, because they're shoved into this grinder, liquefied, and the liquefied gargoyle wings are what's used as the fabric for these wonderful shirts. If you don't believe me, order one. Go to SureDesignT-Shirts.com. Check out their amazing designs, and if you put my name in, you will get 10% off these wonderful, wonderful shirts. We're also sponsored by Audible.com. You can go to audibletrial.com/familyhour. You get a free audiobook. In fact, you could download the Jack Kornfield audiobook that I just played for you for free. So check them out. Finally, we're sponsored by Amazon.com. There is a portal on our website, and this is the easiest thing that you could do to support the podcast. If you are shopping on Amazon, and if you're not shopping on Amazon, what's wrong with you? Are you really going to drive out into the world? Are you really going to drag your meat body into society and deal with the swarms of negative energy pouring off the poor, desperate people who haven't figured out that you can now order everything that you need on the internet without ever having to step foot into the germ-laden hell citadels that are retail stores across America? You don't want to go to to a Target. You don't want to go to a Walmart. Children go into these places and they vomit on literally everything. They put everything into their mouth. They rub their sick botulisms. I don't know why kids have botulism, but kids are dirty, dirty things. They're just filthy. I was in a cafe the other day and there was somebody's kid laying on the floor, literally licking the tiles of a coffee shop. And the mother looked down and said, just building up his immune system. Insane parents, insane children. You don't want to go to a retail store. It's a volcano of pus. It's like shopping inside the boil of a leper. Stay at home. It's safe. You can control everything. Go to Amazon.com, but go through our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. The next time you feel like ordering condoms, butt plugs, the embarrassing things that you don't want to deal with at drugstores, you can order them on Amazon.com and they'll come to your house. They also, if you live in New York or LA, there's something called Amazon Fresh. It's amazing. Grocery delivery service, and it's healthy, organic groceries. I tried. I ordered delicious kale. Kale is never delicious, but I ordered healthy kale and some salmon. Amazon.com, go through our portal. And finally, if you really want to go nuts and support this podcast, you can support us by either by donating, and thanks to those of you who have been donating, or by buying a t-shirt or poster or sticker or downloading one of our bonus episodes. Thanks for hanging in through this introduction, everybody. I love all of you. Thank you so much for listening. And now it is with great pleasure and joy that I turn the podcast over to two of the most interesting people on planet Earth. Chris Ryan, who is the author of the best-selling book, Sex at Dawn, which is a sort of biological approach to exploring monogamy and non-monogamy and polyamory, and also an anthropological observation of the different ways that people deal with monogamy or non-monogamy. And it's an incredible book. And it will reduce guilt that you might be feeling if you're in a monogamous relationship and think something might be going wrong because you're, you know, wanting to hump somebody, your neighbor or something. It's completely natural. Chris Ryan also has an incredible podcast called Tangentially Speaking, and you can find that by going to feralaudio.com. Also joining us on this podcast is the legendary comedian Joe Rogan, who is host of the Joe Rogan Experience podcast, which is one of the most popular podcasts on planet Earth. He's also one of my best friends, and I love him. So now, everybody, please open your third eyes, send your love tendrils in the direction of Chris Ryan and Joe Rogan.
Jungle. There's a grunt solo in that song.
Really?
I was listening to, there's like a whole, like a maybe 20-second section where the guy's just going, get it up now. It's fantastic.
That was Chris Ryan that you just heard, everybody. And we are here on one of the most epic Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcasts of all time. I'm here with the great Chris Ryan, and my friend and mentor, Joe Rogan.
That's a lot of responsibility. I really can't be your mentor.
Maybe I've graduated.
You're 100%. We're just buddies.
That makes you a mentee.
But you did. You did take me under your wing. You totally did.
You could put it that way. What I saw is an awesome human being that could use a little bit of help.
It worked.
You know? Duncan and I have had some awesome times together. We lived together for a bit.
Really?
Yeah. Duncan lived in my place for a little bit.
Yeah, I was engaged to be married, and my fiance left me at the altar, and
what?
I ended up.
Yeah, she gave me, virtually.
Not really, but she gave me the boot, and I ended up at Joe Rogan's house, and what's really funny about
crying in the rain?
No, it was pretty seamless.
Oh, it was seamless, but I was depressed as fuck.
You were depressed.
I was depressed, man, and I can remember like driving up to your house. I don't remember whose car. Was it my car? Maybe it was in my car. I was riding up to your house, and I'm trying to play Elliot Smith because I'm so depressed. And you're like, turn this shit off.
You're like wallowing. You had a whole fucking swimming pool full of mud. You were just rolling around in it, wallowing.
But that was the cool thing. He wouldn't let me, he kept pushing me away. What you're doing was really smart because you were like just sort of in a cool way pointing to where I am like wallowing or getting off on the pain. I never really, it took me probably a few years after that to realize just how much I was using suffering as a drug to get off on, but that was the beginning of really realizing, like, wow, man, I get off on this. Like, I want this kind of experience. I want this kind of suffering.
A lot of people do, man. A lot of people enjoy the extremity, extremity of the pain, of the knowing that their life is falling apart, and then they almost, like, it's a self-fulfilling thing. They just create more drama and more bullshit in their life. I was just telling you, like, dude, you're a young, funny, smart comedian. You're already good. Like, your life is a fucking amazing ride right now. Oh, this girl doesn't like you anymore. One day she'll love you, okay? One day she'll miss you so much. Just come on in.
Yeah.
And Duncan started going in my tank every day. He started going in the isolation tank. And that's, like, a big part of, like, what allowed him to sort it out really pretty quickly, dude. I mean, you don't give yourself enough credit for how quickly you bounce back and we're, like, talking like really rationally about the situation because it was pretty quick.
I wish that I could say I agree with you, but I don't think I really bounced back. It took me a long time to figure out that pattern, but I just went, you know, I've been cleaning my house and I went through this closet and I had just six boxes filled with journals from the last 15 years of my life, maybe longer. And the really dismaying realization that came to me was the shit I was writing in the journal when I was 16 is almost identical to the shit I was writing in that journal that you found at your house after that breakup.
Yeah.
Oh,
this
wow.
endless
you found a journal? Like loop. The bread song?
I found a journal. I didn't read it out of respect, but my housekeeper wrote in Duncan's journal. Duncan left his journal behind, and she wrote a love letter to her boyfriend.
What?
In the same journal.
Yes, yeah, it's in there. That journal's just a magnet for tears.
Isn't that hilarious? Like, I didn't know about it. I Duncan left it at my place for fucking years. It was sitting on my desk for years. And I swear to God, I never read it. I opened it up and I said, oh, this is Duncan's journal. But I have a lot of respect for what people write. There's no way I would read your shit.
That's very cool.
It's not I would know. I mean, there's no way.
It just took you years to get around to giving it back.
No, he just never came by and got it. And even came by my house since then, but never wound up getting it for whatever reason. And
you guys were stoned.
One day, yes, okay, most likely. But one day I handed it to him. And then just the other day, he sends me a text. He's like, dude, that fucking journal has like a Spanish love letter.
You want me to read it? Have you translated it?
No. Out of respect for my housekeeper, please don't.
I put it into Google Translator, and it was definitely a love letter, but I couldn't really make out. It was very sweet.
Why did she write it in your journal?
I think it was just laying around my house, and she didn't think it was anything, you know? She thought it was just some open pages that she could write in. It was just sitting there, you know?
My fantasy was that some mystical Spanish shaman had read my journal and wrote the answer to my problems at the back, like, oh, wandering soul, I know you're suffering and here, but it's just another love-stricken human. What is the
How creepy would that be if it was that? And some of that'd be like a premise in a movie. Like some magical woman wrote in your journal and like you like set up security cameras. How the fuck is she getting in?
Yeah.
She keeps writing in your journal every night.
I knew
in Spanish.
Yeah, I know when you are ready, you will read this. And I know, you know, like now is the time. Now is the time.
Like a reverse Sinister, a horror movie where the ghost loves you.
They keep like fucking up trying to help you.
Yeah.
But they get in the way, you know? Or the timing is bad or something.
Yeah, man. What is that?
The conflict in the
Chris
script.
Ryan, what is that? Why you are the master of evolutionary biology. Why is it built into us this thing where we lament and suffer and miss people that we've been intimate with? What is that? Is there some reason for that? Is there a biological explanation for that?
Yeah, I think so, because the feeling loved by people, feeling protected and respected by people is survival. You know, for our mm-hmm. species, that's what made us survive, that we had these communities that were so multidimensional and interdependent. This is why being rejected by friends hurts worse than anything.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you've got a group of friends and, you know, for some reason they decide they don't want to hang with you anymore, that hurts worse than, you know, like losing a limb long term. Mm. It's a very, very painful thing for human beings.
That makes sense to me, man, but I don't that makes sense to your friends and your family.
Right.
But why someone that you're mating with, this heartbreak is this.
Well, it's even more intense because you're allowing yourself to be completely intimate with them. You're naked with them.
Yeah,
you're
they've touching really seen tongues. You.
You know, you're touching tongues, your penis is inside them. You know, you're grabbing her ass, you see her asshole. You know, all things that you
taste your ass.
Wait, is that with a W or?
It's an H, just a regular just H. But it could be whole. It's both.
Yeah.
In fact.
Well, I was thinking about this. I was talking to a friend earlier today, actually, about this and how the way I knew this woman in a city we won't name, who had a job where she worked about 10 hours a day. She lived alone. Sexy, beautiful, smart woman. And she couldn't bear to come home alone, so she got a dog. She got this yappy little dog, no offense to Fox, who's not yappy. And this dog stayed alone in her apartment all the time. And there was like a little mat for the dog to shit on, and the neighbors complained. And so, and I was thinking like, and she, I talked to her about it, and she's like, but I love that dog. Wait a minute. You love that dog, or you love the love that dog gives you? Because what you're doing to that dog is cruel.
Yes.
From the dog's perspective, I don't see a lot of love here, right? I see what you're getting out of it. And so I think the problem is that we mistake the feeling of being loved for love.
Ooh, that's demonic. That's so satanic, man. Think about that.
It's just clumsy. It's not demonic.
Yeah.
It's just dumb and poorly thought out. There's nothing demonic about it.
But it's no. You know, it reminds me of this thing I was just reading in Buddhism. In the last time we got together and talked, you were saying there's this passivity in Buddhism. And I was just reading this book, and it was talking about how there is a difference between like mindfulness and being unattached and being detached. Like there's a difference, and a huge difference.
Right.
One difference is you're numb to the world. You're not feeling it. You're actually like shut down to the world. And the other one is you're completely open to the world, but you're not clinging to any single experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the difference between loneliness and aloneness.
The Buddha called that the difference, the one where you're closed off, but you're pretending that you're opened up. He said that is the closest enemy to awakening, because you fool yourself into thinking that you're awakened or you're a realized being just because you're shut off to the world, or you're like playing it cool. But this isn't about playing it cool at all. It's about feeling everything completely.
So what you're saying is that hipsters are satanic.
Yeah,
you're essentially saying that.
Yes.
the detached hipster,
especially the goth ones.
Those are my favorite. Those need the biggest hugs.
Exactly, Joe. It's so funny you said that, man.
let's go hug goths.
They need the biggest
hugs.
We'll
go to some concert and just hug everybody.
They don't want to pat. Don't pat a goth. Rub, like really centrally. with no like self-consciousness. You have to like rub their back with love. Because if you hug them and pat them, they know it's like the dad pat from that awkward fucking dad that's, you know, in the military or something. It doesn't really know what the fuck to do with these little kids. All right, don't cry. Don't kill yourself. I won't be able to deal with it.
Yeah.
Man, it's so funny when you realize that. That thing that you're realizing, that is the seed of compassion. Mm. And the problem with that is when you realize that the whatever you want to call it, it's not just hipsters. Watch Locked Up Raw. Those people are doing the exact same thing. Hardened prisoners who are like, they don't feel anything. They don't feel. All you're seeing is varying degrees of cowardice. You're just seeing a different version of being afraid to experience life.
Well, in your life, going back to you at that moment when you were really depressed, when you broke up with your girl and you guys were separated and you were really freaking out and listening to Elliott Smith, what the message that I think you get when you're kind to other people is you also need to be kind to yourself.
Yeah.
And you were always kind to other people. You're a very friendly, nice, warm guy. But I don't think you were so nice to yourself. And I don't think you appreciated yourself and enjoyed yourself. And me, as an objective observer, sort of objective, your good friend, I love you. I thought you were awesome. We were good friends.
Yeah.
So I didn't get why you would beat yourself up. I didn't get, I'm like, dude, you're awesome. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
Like, you're funny, you're smart, you're introspective, you're constantly analyzing, you have these new angles. Duncan and I used to have conversations when he was the talent booker at the Comedy Store. I would call in, comics would call in and give their dates. Like, they say, hey, I'm here Tuesday and Friday. And then they would, you know, book you. He would give it to Mitzi, I guess. Did you give it to Mitzi?
Mitzi.
Yeah. And later Tommy. Did you have to work with Tommy?
Tommy was my protege.
you created a monster. But Duncan and I would have these conversations where I would call up and we'd have these long conversations. I would just call up and I would say, hey, yeah, I'm here Friday and Saturday. What's going on, man? What are you doing? And then he and I would just have these fucking, you know, we really became phone friends.
Yep.
Oh, this is before you knew each other.
No, we knew each other from the store. Right. You know, the Comedy Store is a real camaraderie environment for us.
It's like comics. An academy.
It's an artist colony.
Yeah, Ari talks about that a lot, too. He was there.
Right? It's like Hogwarts.
It's also a place where everyone is given respect.
Mm.
Like, one of the cool things about the Comedy Store is the highest level comedians will mingle with the Sunday night open micers, and everybody's just comics. You know, that's legitimately true.
Yeah.
You know, we used to hang in the back with Eddie Griffin, Damon Wayans, you know, whoever came by. I mean, it was just comics. When I was nobody, I was there. And when I got
But there's
television.
Still some puffed up turds who come wandering through there. You get to what's cool about it is you get to witness universal justice all the time because you'll see somebody come strutting through there puffed up like they just like had a meeting with Zeus or something. Like
and they have to go on after Joey Diaz.
Yeah. You can watch. Yeah, you'll watch that level of justice, but then you watch a much darker justice, which is that
the audience turns.
No, you see them 3 years later.
Oh,
you know, after whatever. The thing is they got all puffed up about is inevitably faded away.
Yeah,
and that thing that they were using is their main identification or the main thing that they're like, this is, see, I am
a
good person.
I got a show. Best.
I got a show. And then you get to watch. So you get to watch this amazing rise and fall of like, but you really see people for what they are, because when you run into somebody who's all puffed up and shitty because they've gotten a little bit of success, then or you run into somebody like, I remember like watching Robin fucking Williams. Whatever you think about Robin Williams as a comic, that's a famous, super famous megastar as far as comedy goes. And I remember watching him standing outside of the original room and he was talking to two tourists, like, you know, a guy in dad pants and a woman wearing a Hawaiian shirt. And I was like looking at him to see, like, I wonder how he interacts with these people. It was like he's talking to his best friends. He was just right there with them, listening, asking them questions, talking to them, not like in a hurry to get away. And I'm like, that is, once you've seen that, you have no excuse to be a shithead to somebody because you got a fucking Comedy Central special, dum-dum.
Did I tell you my Robin Williams story?
No.
I was at the Improv, did a show at the Improv, like one of the weekend shows where I was headlining for the whole weekend. And I always take pictures with people after a show, try to do as much as possible.
They're great, yeah.
And this guy came up, and I was talking to him, and he was holding my hand, shaking my hand, and telling me – I had this dolphin consciousness bit. I have this bit about this idea. It was a real epiphany that I had when I was really high on pot cookies, watching these dolphins play, and I was playing with them and cheering with them in Hawaii, wild dolphins. And while this was going on, I was like, I think they're no different than us. I think they're just in a different body, and they can't control their environment like we can. And I started trying to analyze what it would be to be a dolphin. And then I thought about it, like, what if I was, like, if I was in his body, what if I literally would be him? I would do what he did. If I lived his life, I would. And then I started thinking about that with people. And I said, well, what if everybody is essentially the exact same thing? We're just going through different biological filters, different life experiences, yes, different genetics, different circumstances that we have to handle. And I changed my way I look at people. I decided to start looking at people as if they were me living another life. Mm. And it really happened. Like, be as nice to someone as you would be to if you ran into you and you were living another life. But you got to really – it's got to internalize. You got to really – it takes a while to put that into your head. So I started doing it in a joke form, just talking about this. And I didn't even realize this guy who was praising this bit was Robin Williams. Wow. I didn't know. He's a tiny guy. Mm. I thought it was just some old guy with glasses. And I was in the middle of shaking hands with this guy and holding this guy's hand when I went – this is fucking Robin Williams. Like, whoa, this is weird.
That's cool.
It was really cool. It was intense. And I've criticized him before. You know, he's not a perfect person. He's done a lot of plagiarism. I think he's very talented, but I also think he has an exorbitant need to be loved, a substantial need to be loved, like a lot of us do. And I think he came from a time of less accountability. You know, our time had experienced a few scandals, the Dennis Leary, Bill Hicks thing, and we'd seen the damages that could be done by plagiarism. And our generation of comics were vehemently against it,
right?
You know,
yeah. And people grow, you know. People change, you know. Whatever, he was on a bunch of coke, you know. Mm-hmm. That's no excuse. Yep. Drugs is not an excuse to be an asshole, but that it's certainly if you're doing something wrong and you're doing cocaine, it's going to amp what you're doing.
100%. 100%. There's no denying it.
Not to pull this too far away, but are you guys familiar with the aquatic ape theory?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that? I would love to have that explained. And while you describe it, I'm going to turn the volume up. So I have to crouch down here.
This is perfect.
You think it sounds okay?
Yeah, it sounds
great. Chris Ryan sounds okay?
Do I sound all right? I sound a little delicious. Distant. I sound great. I'm told I have a sexy voice.
You don't think he sounds distant? Because I'm wearing different headphones than you guys are.
Well, listen to mine. Because
sorry about this, you guys.
Don't worry about this. Don't worry, I'm telling you.
So should I just do the grunt solo
let's hear it.
Jungle Boogie? Get it up now.
Oh, no. He's fine. It's my headphones.
It's your headphones.
Right. There you go.
Just your headphones are probably slightly unscrewed or something.
Sorry about that, you guys.
So
good headphones, you cheap bastard. You got fucking sponsors now. You're living in a house.
I know, these do feel kind of plasticky, don't they?
I got those. Those are old.
They're dog shit.
Those are from the old days. I do need to upgrade.
Well, there's some charm to them. Keep it bohemian.
Exactly.
So,
aquatic ape theory, right. The basic idea is that humans, at some point in the distant past, millions of years ago, after we split from the chimpanzees about 5 million years ago. So we're talking 3-4 million years ago probably. The idea is that these proto-hominids lived along the shoreline in parts of Africa that were warm and the water's warm. And so the place that has the most food and is the safest is the sort of tidal zone of the water. So you've got – and when you're in that kind of area, you're not getting attacked by sharks because it's not really deep enough for sharks to come in. And you're not getting attacked by leopards and terrestrial predators because you're in the water. So plus there's clams and, you know, mussels and all this kind of shit in the water. So there's a lot of food there. And it's comfortable. The water temperature is close to body temperature, so it's comfortable that way. So the idea is that at some point these animals split into two species, one of which eventually became dolphins and the other of which came back to land. But the sort of explanation for all this is that there's a lot of stuff about humans that appears that's convergent with marine mammals. Like, for example, of all the apes, we're the only ones who have saltwater tears. We're the only ape with subcutaneous fat.
Wow.
We're the only ape that if you drop an infant in water, it knows to hold its breath. Any other ape, you drop a baby chimpanzee in water, it just breathes water and drowns. A human, you've seen that cover of that Nirvana record, you know, that's a baby underwater holding his breath.
What dick is doing the experiment where he's dropping baby chimps in water?
Hey, it's knowledge. You got to pursue knowledge.
What's the evolutionary mechanism of becoming a dolphin from a chimp or from an early chimp?
That's wild.
Well, you know, all aquatic mammals were – at some point land animals.
That's
right?
So
that's why
fucked.
They have lungs.
That really hurts my brain when I start thinking about how long it took for that to take place.
Yeah. It's hard to get that, wrap your head
and
around.
That throws a giant monkey wrench into the whole aliens made humans theory. Ka-clank.
Yeah.
The difference between a person and a monkey is not nearly as weird as the difference between a monkey and a fucking dolphin.
Right. But now here's what's really interesting. If you look at dolphin anatomy, it's almost the same as human anatomy. Wow. The brain, the heart, the lungs, the, you know, like inner anatomy of a dolphin's very similar to human.
I like what you're saying. It leaves room for mermaids. What you're saying, it really does. What's the in-between space, man? It's like you have these proto-hominids and then you have the dolphin, but in between there, you've got a merman.
Well, the idea is that mermaids were manatees. You know, manatees?
I know. I've heard that like horny sailors pulled manatees on their ships and fucked them. I don't buy it either.
They didn't fucking – nobody waved a magic wand or hit a microwave button and all of a sudden a chimp became a dolphin. It was a process.
Yeah, I have been so horny, man, in my life.
Yeah, that's
but
what I'm thinking.
I have never been so horny that I would fuck a manatee. Do you know how horny you have to be? If you've seen a fucking sea cow, a manatee, it's got barnacles and oozing sores.
People fuck some weird shit. I mean, I don't need to tell you that. You know, people fuck farm animals and, you know, pieces of meat folded over and stuffed in a manatee's
jar. Let's think about the difference between fucking a sheep and fucking a manatee.
All right.
A sheep, you've got a – it's in your barn. You corner the thing and you can fuck it. It's you're not really – you're raping a sheep. Let's just tell the truth.
Who
this
knows?
Thing doesn't want you in there.
Well, yeah. You know that.
It probably doesn't know it wants you. If it had to choose, if you'd say stomp once for you want me to fuck you, stomp twice for no, it would probably fucking keep, you're not gonna fuck me, man. Just give me some food and stop.
But wait a minute, I gotta stand up for the
what an unlucky sheep. You're taking my fucking fur, now you want to fuck me.
You're killing my babies and eating them too, by the way. That's what lamb is baby sheep. You know, when they get older, they get tough and wiry, and it's not
well,
so
see,
good
unless
it's a stew.
I'm thinking you might go to the sheep, and the sheep's like, wait a minute, you're going to fuck me, or you're going to kill me and eat me? I'll take the fucking.
Well, that sounds like rape. Well, if you fucking storm a village and said, listen, you got a choice. I'm going to fuck your baby, or I'm going to kill it and eat it.
Yeah. That's romance. That's romance. That's
Jesus
that's
Christ. You're like, well, when you fuck
right
it, do
there.
I get it back?
That's a quality problem.
Anyway, here's the – I mean, the deciding factor is, you know, you're on a ship, right?
Yes.
You're on some fucking ship
with
like
your friends.
40 friends. You're with like a bunch of British rapists at sea for five years, killing whales or whatever the fuck you're doing, beating seals around
Eating,
the world.
Yeah.
There are no Splinters. Sheep, dude. There are no sheep. It's like a manatee or, you know, some ugly British dude.
I picked the ugly British dude. What? Over. Listen, man, if I've got to pick between fucking some like withered version of Russell Brand with like a with a hook hand, or I've got
and a sunburn,
or I've got to dive into the shark infested waters to try to like lasso a massive rhino type thing.
I don't think they're actually fucking it. I think it's more of a just an idea that there could be a woman out there.
I think they just saw them and like, wow.
I think we have a hard time understanding A, what it would be like to live in an area where if you wanted to picture something, you had to fucking draw it.
Right.
I mean, you're talking
Good
about
point.
A long ass time ago.
Right.
And
yeah.
their perception of all these unique things that they would encounter was insanely ignorant. You literally knew what – I don't like the way I said that. It sounded very pretentious the way I said literally.
It did.
Literally.
I didn't
literally
catch it.
You literally
ignorant.
Knew. You literally knew what you saw. And that is it. Everything else was a really abstract expression of these things. If you saw the Rocky Mountains in a painting, would you really know what the Rocky Mountains look like? No, you would have to take this artist's interpretation of that experience. But if you were there and you saw the Rocky Mountains, you would be like, wow, that's the fucking Rocky Mountain. Like, you only know what you've experienced. So all of a sudden, you're on a boat and there's this undocumented animal that you find in a place where you've had nothing but fucking potatoes for 6 months and you're dying of diseases and everyone smells like shit and they're throwing up and vomiting. You would imagine that it was a woman. You saw her in the water. It was misty. It was dark. There's a woman in the water. There's a woman in the water. She's calling to me, man. Some crazy fuck really thinks that it's a woman. He jumps overboard. He's dead. the siren dragged him to the rocks. No, he was an asshole. That guy was an asshole. There was a test, a massive test. We all got in a wooden boat and sailed across the ocean. This guy failed. He failed hardcore. The siren called me to the rocks. No, the universe wanted you to get your weak fucking seeds and jump overboard with them.
Guaranteed nobody stopped him from jumping
They're
in
like, there. Hey, 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 there's a fucking mermaid in there for you, Tommy. Yeah.
She's calling you.
Tommy.
Go to her.
Hey, it wasn't his fault. Mrs. Johnson, they led him with magic to the rocks.
Yeah. I like that these sailors turned into like New Jersey garbage men.
The floating mafiosi.
Yeah, they're just assholes.
Well, okay, now following your line of logic there, then, do you think that the human imagination is devolving, is withering away because we've got like now it's like you don't even have to imagine anything. Like, when's the last time you jerked off without looking at porn? Like,
all the
can
time.
You just close
I do
your
that
eyes?
In bed. Yeah, I do that really? In bed. Yeah, if I'm in bed and I need to go to sleep, I just think about things and I jerk off.
Wow. All right. So you still got a vivid
imagination. Do you have like your top five masturbation memories?
Spank.
No. They're all just functional.
You make stuff up.
Yeah, sometimes. It's not just caveman shit. Just get it out of my body so I can go to sleep. I'm not like trying to enjoy the fantasy. It's not like sex. Like, you know, when you, I think it's, one of the, there's people that, there's people that appreciate sex, and there's people that I bet nobody wants to fuck. Because the people that – when nobody wants to fuck you, for whether it's a physical thing or your personality, you probably don't appreciate what it's like when two people actually want to fuck each other. Like, without saying anybody's name, a friend of mine was telling me the other day that he just got back with his ex-girlfriend. They had a little bit of a breakup. And he got back with his ex-girlfriend, and I was like, how was it when you guys fucked? It's like, it was fucking incredible. It was amazing.
Are you talking about me?
I don't want to say it.
I wasn't gonna say.
Well, I don't know if you like talking about personal things on the air.
On my last podcast,
you went into depth about it.
No, on the last podcast, I actually asked the audience, "Is it possible to get back together with your ex girlfriend? Does anyone have that?
Don't ever ask that question.
Is that ever
because of course it's possible. You're doing it.
But no, I'm glad I asked because you get This is the thing I'm learning. As a side note, before we get into that, as a side note, here's what I'm learning. The audience, I ask them questions about stuff, and they email me answers, and they're fucking good answers. Like, the last podcast I asked, because I got to get chest x-rays tomorrow, because I have to do this every 4 months, and it sucks, and it stresses me out. And it's like, I don't like doing this. I'm freaked out about it. And for 2 years, I've got to be freaked out every 4 months. I've got to get freaked out every 4 months to get these x-rays. Is anyone out there dealing with this? Do you have tricks for how to deal with this? Because I don't know how to deal with it. I keep freaking out over it. And man, I got like so many responses, and all the responses were like, some of them were like, I have a cyst in my brain. I have stuff from people who are experiencing the whole spectrum of medical anxiety. And wow, man, it really helps me to read all the different, the advice that they gave me. Like, the best advice, the best advice was, it sounds morbid, but it's pretty cool, which is like, look at your life. Find out what you love about your life, what you're proud of that you've done in your life. Think about what you've done and realize that even if right now you die, you've had a great life. Just recognize that. Just recognize that you're living right now. Be in the moment. People keep saying that. Mm-hmm. Like, bring it back to the moment. Don't cling to things and just know that you can't stop time. No matter what, the situation's going to change. So I got that just from throwing this question out there. The thing about the ex-girlfriend – I got a bunch of sweet emails back, which is like, I'm married. I married a girl I broke up with, and we have kids, and I love her, and the home's filled with love, but it was hard. It's hard. And so anyway, and yes, the sex is amazing when you get back together with your ex-girlfriend.
Praise
Allah.
My point being that people that don't think that sex is a big deal, I don't think they've experienced sex with someone who wants to have sex with them, whether it's their physical body, whether it's their personality, whether it's the relationship that they chose. I mean, there's people that have unappealing bodies to you or I, but to each other, they love each other so much, their bodies are delicious.
Right.
I think there's a lot of people that don't get that success, just like some people never get good friends. I know a woman, she is in her 70s, and she doesn't have any friends. And she hasn't had any friends for a long time. She has children, and she stays in touch with them, and she's kind of burdensome in a way because she's very overbearing and always negative, but she doesn't have friends. And then there's people like you and I who have a bunch of great friends.
Right.
I mean, one of the main reasons I stay in L.A., one of the main reasons why I don't just fucking pack up and go to Colorado, is because all my friends are here.
Me too. We're all fucking each other up because we're stuck in L.A.
Well, I'm getting very close to buying a giant chunk of land in Colorado and starting a compound.
Wow.
You know
what? Very close.
I was thinking about this. I was listening to you and Shane Smith talking about this.
Yes.
And he was saying how the more he sort of gets to know these people in the upper echelons of government and corporations, the more he sees that a lot of them have, like, what's he call it, an escape hatch or something.
Yeah.
Like a piece of land, a house, somewhere, if shit gets crazy, they've got a place to go, right? And I was thinking about that. And the problem with that is they'll be alone. And what we really should do is, like, people like you guys are talking about, like, and you guys really have a community. I don't really have that. I'm tempted to move to L.A. actually simply because I've met so many great people.
Dude,
move
here.
I hate L.A.
Come here with us.
You know, you.
I don't live in L.A.
Well, you live. You know,
I live out in the boonies.
Right. I lived
in Topanga
last winter.
Yeah, that's the boonies.
That's
great, Topanga has fucking deer.
But you drive an hour like to hang with Duncan for an hour. Then you drive an hour back.
So what? You know how often I do that? It's not that often. What do you have, a 9-to-5 job that I don't know about?
No,
that you gotta commute to?
No.
You can fucking be in traffic at 7 a.m. to be
had
on time.
A job for
exactly.
A long
so what
time,
are you worried about? The times that you're driving are going to be completely unusual.
Yeah.
Not only that, like you don't have to be centrally located. You don't have to live in the shit.
Yeah.
You know, you
yeah.
just live in a nice place where it's quiet. Fuck. Right. You could live in Santa Barbara.
I love Topanga.
I like
but anyway,
Barbara's
anyway, my point is that like I really like this idea of having a place out there that you can escape to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the key is have the community.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Yes.
Like have 15 really good friends all you don't have to own the same property or whatever, but you're all there. So like you can all go there in the summer and you you know, it's like, wow, let's all get away together. Because being isolated,
it's whack.
It ain't gonna work. Yeah.
It's like that movie where the kid Into the Wild, is that it?
Yes.
The guy goes to the woods and then he realizes once he's in the woods, you can't enjoy this by yourself.
Right.
Like we fucking need each other, whether we like it or not, we need each other.
Yeah.
I like it. I like that we need each other because I think if you put out the right vibe, you can surround yourself with the right people and you can have a cool group of humans that you surround yourself with.
Well, that gets us back to the first point you raised, right? Like why do we get so attached to somebody who loves us? It's because that's your community. Think of how many people you know whose community is their mate.
We obviously are separate. We obviously are different from each other. We're separate from each other, but yet we're not. Because we can't rely on each other. We can't exist. If we exist completely solitary, we either go crazy or we were crazy in order to accept that.
Right.
Like when you think about like the fucking Unabomber type, the Ted Kaczynski guy. He's by himself in the woods in a cabin and writing crazy shit.
Yeah.
Just completely by himself. Like that's a broken mind.
What's the worst punishment you can give a criminal?
Solitary confinement.
Yeah.
Right. And Amnesty International considers that torture, by the way.
It is.
Well, it is. I mean, you think about what happened to Bradley Manning after he released all those WikiLeaks documents. They left that guy naked in a cold room where he could barely keep his body temperature warm enough to stay alive, and they gave him solitary for years.
24-hour light.
24-hour light.
And the dude was not convicted of anything at the time.
These demons.
Sorry. And they kept it going on for years. It's really unbelievably evil, and anyone involved in that should be stripped of power. They should remove them from any position of power right away. They'll say, what you're doing is fundamentally anti-human, regardless of what this guy did. If this guy ate babies, I could maybe understand it, and maybe you should just shoot him and get it over with. But all this guy did was he made a moral judgment about information that he believed would change the way people view what he believes is an unjust war because he's a part of it.
Right.
If that's not a debate, what kind of a fucking society do we have? If that's not subject for debate, and if this guy is a traitor because he showed something that actually did take place,
that was illegal.
Yeah, that whole fucking thing where they're shooting missiles and they find out that there's kids in the van. They're like, well, fuck them. They shouldn't take their kids. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
We that is no judgment. Take judgment out. That is information. Okay, and that's information that we should all have access to if we want to make an informed decision about whether or not we support a war.
Right.
Whether we – no judgment aside. We don't say you those guys are pigs, they should die. Or, hey, those guys are in a crazy situation. They're just human beings and you and I would do the exact same thing. Forget both sides of that coin
right.
and just say that's information.
It's like one of your kids comes to you and tells you that their uncle is molesting the other kid. And so, like, if you have two kids and a kid tells you, hey, you know, John's getting molested by Uncle William. And then instead of being like, thank you for telling me, you're very courageous for telling me that, we're going to take care of this, you're safe. It's like, you little shit.
Yeah. You take that kid and you put him in a room, you lock him in the light on and take his clothes off and turn the air conditioning on. Daddy, I just wanted to save William.
But also, I mean, take it to the next level. Like you said, even if he's eating babies, you know, maybe you should shoot him, whatever. The thing is, we've got this incredibly punitive sense of punishment where, like, even if the guy is eating babies, it doesn't help anyone to torture him.
Right.
Right? Those babies are gone.
Exactly.
So all you're doing is you're saying, we got to separate this guy from society. So do that.
Not really. What they're really doing is they're letting that information get out so everyone knows if you ever fuck up and go against the government again, expect this.
We will fuck you.
This is what we do.
Fuck you as hard as we can.
But you know, the thing is, and you're right about that, of course, there's a publicity element to this. But the thing is, we're doing this, the United States government is doing this to thousands of prisoners all over the country who are in perpetual solitary for the rest of their lives for no purpose. There's no reason. It's just because they're bad and we want
to
fuck them.
It's important to realize that it's not just the United States government. It's all governments. It's most governments.
Wait a minute. We've got a higher percentage of our population in prison than any other country on earth.
That's because every other country you can just get away with crime and no one gives a fuck. Go to China and kill somebody. They go, wow, what do you want me to do?
No, China, they execute. Fuck, man. The goddamn, those wax museums filled with plastinated
coils. I'm very busy, Duncan. I cannot investigate. What do you want me to do?
So I can say I was not here during this racist element.
How is it
show?
Racist to make a Chinese accent? I really want to know how you can't make fun of. I make fun of an Englishman? And am I a racist now?
Yeah.
No.
Well, and how come Chinaman's racist as a word and Englishman
isn't? Exactly, mate. No. Is it racist to talk about Australians?
No, that's not racist. But if I go, Duncan Trussell, you kill someone. I am very busy. Now, all of a sudden, I'm a racist. Or are Chinese people ultra fucking... And it's not even Chinese people complaining, by the way. It'd be white liberals with armpit hair. That are like, enough of this fucking male privilege. White male privilege.
Did you see what trouble Natasha got in?
That was so great.
Did you see her awesome apology letter?
Yes, it was fantastic.
Non-apology letter. It was beautiful.
It was about as good as it could get.
I tweeted that and some guy was like, some like smug dickhead was like, oh yeah, her publicist just set that whole thing up. This is all just to, you know, raise her profile.
That's just a fool.
Dude.
There's no need to even talk about that guy.
These paranoid fucks, man. They're the same people who...
government, man.
No, the fucking... What are they called? The drama actors, conflict actors. What are they called?
What do you have in your hand that's been lit on fire?
This?
Yeah.
Aubrey gave me this. This is the wood that they burn when you're doing ayahuasca ceremonies. It smells really good. Okay. But
all right. I'm going to get a beer. Is anyone else?
I'll take one. Let's take a pause.
We don't have to pause. You want to pause?
No, we don't have to pause.
Okay, we'll just wait for Chris to come back.
You guys keep talking.
No, it's what are those things?
What were we just? Let's talk about Chris. He's beautiful.
He's a beautiful man.
What did we? What were we talking about right before I interrupted you? So rude.
Oh God. Like that's like a component of podcasts is interrupting each other and then forgetting what we're talking about.
That's a big part of it. And people at home going, what the fuck? You guys never completed that story.
Well, dude,
can I smell that?
Yeah.
What is it called? Do you know?
I can't remember.
It's really light.
But that's the
I bet that smells like doing ayahuasca.
Yeah, it sure does, doesn't it?
It smells like fear.
or love.
Yeah, but they're both the same. They're next door neighbors.
Oh, they are. Well, fear is like, yeah.
Isn't it weird that we let everybody use fire? Well, any fucking asshole. Anybody. You can be a 5-year-old kid. Can I get some matches?
You don't have to have a fire license.
You don't have a license to use fire.
One of the most destructive forces on earth.
Ridiculous element. And think about all the different things that are flammable that you could just buy slowly but surely and accumulate from a liquor store or from any drug store. Just think about go to a car place. You know, think about all the different things you could light on fire.
Dude, I was just watching this show. It's I don't remember what it's called, but basically they just they drop ex-military vets in really places. Yeah.
Dude, you're screwed.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, man. Yeah. And this guy, he took some kind of component that's in the stuff that you put into flowers, you know, like the little packets that come when you have flowers and you dump it in the water.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that and you mix it with antifreeze, it creates a flammable chemical and bursts and like will start a fire.
Whoa.
So if you take flour powder and mix it with antifreeze, it starts a fire. You don't even need a fucking match. You just like pour that and flour powder and boof. Wow. I now know flour powder is the word for it. It sounds like a type of acid or something. But, dude, the thing I wanted to talk to you about that you were describing with the dolphins is something that I've been reading, which is so I'm reading this book on Buddhist psychology by Jack Kornfield, and it's fucking awesome how deep Buddha went into breaking down the way human beings experience reality. And so the idea is that there is a field of consciousness that we are in, like water, like fish swimming in water. So there's a field of consciousness that we're in. And they compare it to – they use two comparisons. They compare it to a mirror, this consciousness, this field of consciousness. In the way you look in a mirror can be reflecting anything. It can be reflecting a beautiful girl. It can be reflecting tigers eating somebody. The mirror is not affected by the reflection at all. So that's this field of consciousness, completely non-affected by the things that are emerging into it and never touched by the things emerging into it. So the field of consciousness is like a thing that is flowing through us and we're flavoring it with our experiences. So the experiences that you have as a person is like dropping dye into water, and there's these temporary colorings of this field of consciousness, and that's the human experience. And so the idea is you begin to watch. If you begin to watch, you'll start to notice that your experience is broken down into bits, into like these little beads or moments of experience. And the more you meditate, apparently, the more you realize that, like, you know, the way you breathe, like if you start watching your breath, this is what I love about meditation. I've been meditating lately, and you just watch your breath. That's it. So you sit, you watch your inhales through the nose and exhales through the mouth, and you just watch your breath. That's all it is. You just watch your breath, and suddenly you realize, fuck, man, I've never paid attention to the way I breathe. Like, I've never even noticed the way I breathe. And you'll notice that when you inhale, there's a microsecond where you're not breathing anymore. The breath stops. There's a pause in between the inhale and the exhale, and the exhale and the inhale. There's this weird little pause, this moment of no breathing. And that's a really important moment in Buddhism, because it's supposed to it represents the exact same thing that's happening with these moments of experience that make up the thread of our existence. And in between each of these beats or moments of experience, there's this pause. It's a micro pause, like a probably shorter than a millisecond, but it's a pause. And that pause is the field of pure consciousness, which is what we actually are. That's what you really are. You're the person that you think you are is the experience of consciousness meeting this temporary manifestation that's the atomic cloud or swirl of particles that makes up a Joe Rogan. But that's not what you are. You're just consciousness flowing through it like water through a sea cave or something, you know? It's really cool, man. It's really cool, because the idea is that the more you let go of this identity of the self, the more you move into this expansiveness. That's what they call it. They use really cool terms for it. Clear mind. They always use like the sky, expansiveness. It's this open field of freedom. It's freedom, really. So that reminded me of the joke you were talking about. And your joke is very similar to an idea in Buddhist psychology.
That's very fascinating that you flavor reality around you. And that mirrors the idea that psychedelic trips, when you have a psychedelic trip, you are experiencing the psychedelic trips of everyone who's ever experienced them before, all connected together as like a mosaic.
Whoa.
You ever heard that about psychedelics? It's one of the weird things they say about things like what was the shit that Special K, ketamine. Timothy Leary was really into John Lilly. Lilly was into ketamine and isolation tanks. He would whack himself with ketamine and go into an isolation
tank. And dolphins.
Yes. His thing was that like McKenna described taking ketamine as – it's like there's no experiences there. You go there, it's like a city of empty office buildings. And you're wandering around, like, where is everybody? Like, what's going on here? And it's like, that's the feeling that you got. Like, you were really new to the party. Whereas if you take mushrooms, you're dealing with thousands and thousands of years of experiences. Right. Also why when you do ayahuasca, you experience snakes, jaguars, all the different things of the jungle, black people. There's all these different like archetypes that repeat themselves over and over again in the ayahuasca experience, so much so that it's really hard to deny that these same things might somehow or another be connected, because this is the experiences of the people that took this ayahuasca in this place for thousands and thousands of years. And there's their concerns. Dancing, jaguars, snakes.
What do you think about that, Chris Ryan?
I've had two ayahuasca experiences. I didn't see any snakes or jaguars in either one of them. But I'm not sure if this is directly related, but I think it is. You're talking about fields and yeah, intersecting fields. I've had experiences twice now, once with ayahuasca and once with peyote, where something really freaking bizarre happened before I took the drug. And in the case of peyote, before I knew I was going to take the drug. So it seemed as if there was some sort of like a field
drawing
that
you
got
into
to
it.
Me first before yes. the experience. Yeah,
so dude, scary. I have had the exact same experience with LSD.
Really?
Where like I can remember back when I used to take acid all the time, I can remember in the morning. I remember once clearly in the morning thinking, I'm going to take LSD tonight. I can already feel that I'm going to take LSD tonight. I had no acid, no access to acid, didn't know anybody who had it. But like that afternoon, I remember running into someone who was selling acid and like he sold me acid and I took it. But I remember feeling like this backwards. I know exactly what you're saying. Like time is melting backwards.
Now, the non-psychedelic skeptic would say, this is because you were thinking about LSD for a long time. So there were many days where you're like, man, I'm going to get acid today. And you didn't get any acid.
Or they're like, we were taking acid every other day. So there's like an 80% chance.
When you say the weird things happen to you, what did you mean? Like, what were these things?
All right. You want me to?
Yeah.
It's like a 3-minute story.
Oh, yeah. Right.
We like it.
So I'm in Brazil, first time ever, with Stanley Krippner, who you've met. Sure. And hopefully you'll meet at some
part?
Point. We were in Porto Alegre. It was my first trip with him. He was my professor in grad school, and he invited me. The first trip I went on with him, and then later he and I went to 30 probably countries around the world together. But this is our first trip together, and before we went, he said, is there anything you'd like to check out when we're in Brazil? We were doing a trip in Porto Alegre, Salvador, and Rio. And Stanley is famous in Brazil, like really famous. Like there was a crowd of people at the airport to greet us and, you know, sign his books. He's the godfather of Brazilian parapsychology. He's like, anyway, so we're in Porto Alegre, and I told him I'd like to check out ayahuasca. So he, you know, wrote to somebody and arranged that we would go and visit one of the two churches in Brazil that has permission to use, governmental permission to use ayahuasca in their ceremonies. There's Santo Daime and União do Vegetal, UDV. So we went to a UDV church. So these guys came and picked us up in Porto Alegre. And we're in the car driving to this place. I'm not sure how far away it is, but we'd been driving, you know, maybe half an hour on the highway. And we turned off and we're going down this bumpy road. Stanley's in the front seat, passenger seat. There's the Brazilian guy driving, another Brazilian guy in the back. And the three of them are all chatting in Portuguese, which I don't speak, but Stanley does. So I'm just looking out the window, right? And we're sort of bumping along this dirt road. And they're, you know, typical scene you'd imagine, like, you know, little houses, chickens, kids running around with no pants on, you know, like a real rural third world kind of scene. We're cruising, we're going along maybe 10 kilometers an hour, just bumping along. And I look and walking down, I'm in the back right seat, and walking down toward us on the left side is this beautiful woman in a sari, like an Indian sari with a bindi, the red dot in her forehead. And she's carrying like a shallow soup bowl, and she's carrying it really carefully so she won't spill it. And she's stepping carefully, and she's hot. So I'm checking her out. And I sort of turn and check her out from the back as we go by. And I'm thinking, man, I hope she's part of this thing. You know, I hope it's close up here because she was really sweet. And then we pull 100 meters out. We pull in. I forget. We're getting out of the car, and I say to Stanley, hey, did you see that woman back there? He said, no. I said, oh, man, smoking woman back there. And this is my first trip to Brazil, so I'm like all keyed up on Brazilian women, you know?
Right.
And so then they show us around the place. They show us where they grow the two plants that they mix, and they make the brew and all that. And then we have a light dinner. And then like 2 hours later, we go into this room where they're going to have the ceremony. And there's a table up front for the guests, one of which is us. And then there are all these folding chairs in rows. And as we go into the room, she's sitting in one of the front rows. And I say to Stanley, yeah, there's that woman I saw. And he said, oh, yeah, she's beautiful. Oh, great. So we go, we sit down, we take the tea. And, you know, the way they do it in that church is you drink, everybody drinks the tea, and then you just sort of sit there in dim lighting for a couple hours. And everyone has their experience. And you just sit there with your eyes closed and you have your experience. Cool. And then there's what they call the mestre, the teacher. They'll bring up the lights and people talk about what they saw, what they experienced. And he'll sort of lead a bit of a group therapy kind of thing, talking about, you know, what we're learning today or what you learned or whatever. It's a very cool thing. Wonderful. Very effective.
I want to do that.
With addictions and things like that. Anyway, so, okay, at this point, I was in the process of separating from a woman I really loved a lot. And there was no anger or
play the Hulk music.
No recrimination.
Do you have that?
What's Hulk music?
Do-do-do-do. The piano music when the Hulk would walk away at the end of every episode.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll play that.
So you're breaking it. Don't play it. Don't listen to me. I'm sorry.
So you can edit that in later. So anyway, it's a very painful process because we loved each other, but she wanted to have kids and, you know, a beach house. And I was like a guy who was never going to have any money. Right. And, you know, that's not my thing. And so
that's sad when you really like someone and you just can't meet.
But you know what? She and her husband are two of my best friends in the world now.
Wow.
And they've got our cats. They've had our cats for the last 2 years and all our shit in their attic.
Really?
Yeah.
No, oh, that's cool.
They're wonderful people. We were at their wedding. You know, it's wonderful. But anyway, but it was very painful because I think when most people break up, they like slice the knot and we were untying it.
Yeah.
You know, trying not to hurt anyone, you know. And so it was painful. And as I was tripping, I kept looking at this woman who was sitting there with her eyes closed. So I wasn't, you know, making her uncomfortable. But I would look at her and she would help me because she would just make me tune me into the fact that there are other women. There will be love. There will be happiness. It's going to be all right. Just remind myself. The world is full of beauty and love. And, you know.
Right.
Anyway, but she doesn't, you know, she's Brazilian. She doesn't even speak English, whatever. It's not about her individually, right?
Yes.
So the whole thing happens, and they do the ceremony and the talking, the therapy and all that. And then it's over, and we get up, and the mestre says, oh, Christopher, have you met Hasila? Her name was Hasila. And she comes over. She speaks perfect English. Hey, how are you? Let's go. And I said, I got to puke because I was like waiting to puke. I ran outside and puked, and I came back in, and I said, man, the gods have a sense of humor because ever since I saw you on the road out there, I've been wanting to meet you. You're just so striking, like, you know, the way you're dressed and you're beautiful and you're here in this rural, like, setting. And wow. And she's like, well, how long are you going to be in Porto Alegre? A few days, whatever. Here's my number, okay? So then I hooked up with her in Porto Alegre. We went out. We had dinner a couple times. She took me to her house. She was much younger than me. She was like 21. I was probably 36 or something at that point.
Right.
And I remember we were lying on her bed in her house. She was showing me pictures. She had grown up, her parents were sannyasin. She had grown up in Hawaii, Oregon, India, and
crazy.
Brazil, which is why she spoke English so well. And she was showing me, and she had been raped. Somebody, when she was 11, had given her acid and raped her.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So she'd had some real traumatic shit. And I remember she showing me pictures and telling me the story. And she looks at me and she says, this is the first time I've ever been alone with a man, and I wasn't afraid.
Wow.
It was so beautiful. Now, I didn't – when I say I hooked up with her, we didn't have sex. It was nothing. It was just, you know, beautiful friendship, right?
Wow, that's so crazy.
Okay, now, last night, the last night I'm in Porto Alegre, I meet her for a drink, say goodbye, and I say to her, you know, this has been great. This is, you know, my first experience in Brazil. She turned me on to Carlinhos Brown, you know. I never heard Carlinhos Brown.
I don't know that.
Oh,
is.
He's like the James Brown of Brazilian music. He's
fantastic.
Really? Yeah, yeah. You'd know his music if you heard it. Anyway, so she turned me on to all this great music. She introduced me to her friends. And I was just like, this is so wonderful to meet you and what you've given me in just a couple of days. And since I saw you on that road, I knew, like, you just had this energy. And she's looking at me and she says, listen, I didn't want to say anything earlier, but now that I know you a little bit, I think you'll be okay with this. I was never on that road.
Holy shit, that's nuts.
She said, I don't know what you saw, but I was taking care of the kids behind the building. I don't know anybody out there. Wow. There's no reason for me to be walking on that road. Where would I be going?
Listen, this is, she had an acid flashback. That's all that is.
That's skeptic.
She forgot she was on the road.
No.
They gave her acid when she was 11. She had an acid flashback when she was 21.
That's somebody who's never taken acid talking, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey,
Joe Rogan has never taken LSD, one of the great travesties of the modern world.
Why is that a travesty?
Because, man, it's one of the classic psychedelics. It's
right, but why do I need to follow all the classics?
The same reason you should read Plato. It's an important experience.
Is this the gentleman, Carlinhos Brown?
Yeah.
That's the dude?
Yeah, he's great.
I want to be a skeptic, but I can't be a skeptic anymore. I believe that there's something else that pokes into the world from time to time.
Well, there certainly is. There no doubt is something else out there. I mean, that's what the imagination is. The imagination is something indescribable. You know, people want to quantify it, and they even want to diminish it by saying that it's something that's silly, and, oh, he's imagining that he's on Mars. Poor little Billy with his, you know, cardboard sword. He's imagining. He's a gladiator. But the imagination is responsible for this fucking podcast. It's responsible for microphones, responsible for electrical cables, responsible for the internet, responsible for the house that you're living in, responsible for every fucking single thing we're wearing, that we drove. Mm. It's all a manifestation of the imagination. The imagination is literally the fucking machine that creates everything we see in human society. It's not a little thing. It's the fucking thing.
Yeah.
It's the thing. Yeah. It's the greatest thing that anybody's ever... Hey, you don't need imagination. What you need is hard work. You fucking show up on time. You do your job and you go to bed with a sense of satisfaction.
And you jerk off and you go...
That guy doesn't have a Budweiser bottle to drink unless someone figured out how to make glass. Okay, that's all the imagination. The imagination is the whole fucking ball of wax. It's just like, it's the silent, oh, shy, I didn't do anything. Oh, me, no, it was you guys. It's the imagination. Right. The whole thing is the imagination.
Yeah. Right.
Even language comes out of the imagination.
Yeah.
The idea of making a noise with your fucking face comes out of the imagination. All of it does. The imagination figured out how to hunt. When you see an orangutan getting ants with sticks, when they stick sticks in there, that is the imagination.
Well, what do you think that is? Describe that. What do you think the imagination is? What is that?
It's the machine that creates, and it's the machine that changes.
Why a machine?
Because I think that it's all the same. I think there's a machine, there's a genetic machine that allows a caterpillar to become a butterfly, and then there's imagination that allows a human being to one day physically manifest the big change.
You know, it's weird, because imagination existed prior to machines. Like, imagination was there when there were no machines.
But it grew the same way humans grew, the same way
machines
a woolly mammoth
grow out
grew.
Of imagination.
Yes, all of it does.
Not that it matters.
Does.
It's, you know, whatever. It's semantics, but it's like the term machine. When I hear the term machine, mm-hmm. I think of this like right yes. angles and a cold dead thing. Yeah. And the imagination
is inorganic.
You know the greatest Marshall McLuhan quote ever?
I know what you're going to say, but say it.
Human beings are the sex organs of the machine world.
Yes.
God damn it. He wrote that in the 60s.
Yeah, we're all like walking clitori. Is that plural? Clitoris is clitori?
It is now.
It is, yeah.
Is it really?
No one's ever used it for more than one. They're too shamed. We're shamed. There's too many. Only one clit is fine. There's no need to say clitoris.
Garden of clitoris.
Clitori.
And clitoris.
Can I interest you in a bowl of clitoris?
I only eat lamb clitori. Well, they kill the lamb, whether you like it or not. It's not so bad to eat the clitoris. It's actually quite green.
It's so weird, though. We are the clitoris of the earth. We're like the earth. We are.
Do you know the clitoris is the only organ in the human body whose sole purpose is pleasure?
You obviously never seen my butt.
Speaking of
haven't ever documented it.
Yeah,
pure pleasure.
Speaking of which, Connor Habib says hello.
I tell myself.
Speaking of which, Connor Habib says hello. That's hilarious.
I just talked to him the other day, and he was like,
yeah, I got to do a podcast with that dude. I heard he's quite fascinating.
He is. He's super cool.
Super smart.
I'm a bad friend. Cool. I got to go have coffee. That guy, I'm sorry, Connor Habib. I'm a bad friend.
Oh, sweetie. You're a good friend.
He loves you. He loves you.
You'd never fucking clean out your voicemails, though. I like Duncan's strategy for never getting voicemails. Yes. He never deletes voicemails.
Very intentional.
Can't you just not have a
extremely
voicemail box?
Just text.
I had to take on that that strategy for the Rogan board. I was getting too many private messages because you could just send me a private message. I can't answer them all. It's impossible.
Yes.
Dude, somebody tweeted something yesterday, like with me and you, and I don't know. It was that thing with you and Nancy Grace. Did
you see that? Yeah.
So for some reason, it was like Nancy Grace saying, you know, pot makes you fat and sloppy, and Joe saying, you can abuse anything, even cheeseburgers. And there's a picture of Joe looking like super, you know, fit. And Nancy Grace looking sloppy and fat. And so the point was, you know, come on. But anyway, my name was, for some reason, my Twitter handle was included in that.
Yeah.
And now, like, I can't, like, look at Twitter because it's just flooded with, like, retweets and, you know, mentions. Like,
my Twitter is a cascade. I have 1,200,000, and as of the time of this podcast, somewhere around 250,000 people. So
I like that you keep that much of a track on the fucking
I'm on it every day. I think it's a valuable resource for communication. I learn more from things people send me. It's the way it used to be. It's like the idea of Twitter was like super narcissistic. Everybody was like, I don't give a fuck if you're going to the movies. Right. I don't give a, because that's where people would do, like, on my way to the show, on my way to the movies, in the car with Mike, you know, like, people were writing really dumb shit. And then somewhere along the line, people said, no, this is good because it keeps people from being verbose. This 140 text limit is actually probably a good idea because it shrinks URLs. You have the tiny URL option. So because of that, you're allowed to, like, transmit information at a rate that's just never been possible before because blogs are too goddamn long.
Right.
Nobody wants to read your bullshit. Nobody wants to watch your video where you pontificate for fucking 20 minutes. But if you send a tweet, and the tweet's 140 characters, science invents new form of skin, you know, whatever. You send it to me, and I'm like, holy shit.
Yes.
I read it, and I retweet it. 1,200,000 people then have access to that, and then they go, oh, if you fucking send that guy some cool shit, he'll retweet it, and then 1,000,000 people will see it. Send it to him. So they send it to me, and you become like a portal.
But how do you manage the volume?
I can't. I do what I can do.
So you just
I don't have any obligation.
When you've got time, you read whatever's current, and you miss whatever
I do it in good faith. Yeah. I do it all in good faith. I read what I can. I go on when I can. I do, but I don't let it take over my life because it would take over every second of every day, of every minute. It would be impossible to ever have time to do anything else.
That thing you just fucking tweeted, dude, of the Iranian man who hasn't taken a shower in 30 years.
He smokes animal shit.
He smokes shit.
Yeah, he smokes animal
dung. It's like the dirtiest man on earth. it's he's comedically dirty. Like,
you see the picture of him with six cigarettes in his hand?
Yes.
That's fucking amazing.
And you would fuck him before a manatee?
No.
Really?
No.
I don't think so.
There wouldn't be a hesitation.
That's the line.
I wouldn't want to be within a 20-mile radius of that guy.
Yeah. I feel like I'm really fortunate to be in this weird portal position. And that's how I view my take on things, is that for people have entrusted in me the responsibility of being a portal because I've been so adamant about my thoughts and what I believe and, you know, my philosophies and being nice to people and that we're all together in this thing. And then because of that, people tweet me shit on a regular basis and they know that I'll tweet it out. So what I think it really is like it's a portal situation. Like, this guy can handle it. He knows what to do with this. Send him the information. You know, you send someone the information, they can pow, 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 and they can send it to 1,000,000 people. That's never existed before. A good TV show on cable, if you're lucky, we got 1,000,000 viewers last night. Wow. Well, Twitter gets 1,000,000 viewers every fucking minute.
Yeah.
Every minute of every day, anything you send. Dr. Chris Ryan, you know, you send Chris Ryan, PhD, you send that to me, I send that out, and then the people that are on my Twitter, the combined millions of them. So if someone sends something like retweeted 6,000 times, it's not just retweeted 6,000 times. It's retweeted 6,000 times and then seen by how many people on each retweet.
it's exponential.
You know what, man? Yeah. There was a transhumanist I met at that GF 2014 2045 convention we went to, which is that convention
the Russian thing?
Yes,
yeah.
by the Russian billionaire.
Yeah, I saw that episode.
Dmitry Ichkov.
Yes.
But I can't remember his – God damn it. I wish I could remember his name. He's really cool. He listens to our podcast. But he was talking about how like Twitter and technology is actually creating these sort of technological – neurological correlates.
Not Jason Silva.
It wasn't Silva. No, this was like
one of the other guys there. There's so many smart guys there.
But the idea is, it's like what you're talking about is you sort of become a synapse and in this sort of technological brain, and it's like all this information is like flowing through, and you're sort of like picking what information to continue up the line. And what I really love about what you're saying is you step away from the ego. You step away from the idea it's me, and you realize, like, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, I'm a conduit for information. And
that's really what it is.
That is what it is.
It's a nice way to say it. You know, you're complimenting me, saying, you know, step away from the ego, but it is what it is. I'd be a fool to think it's anything other than that.
Just don't step into the ego.
Yes.
Yeah.
But some people do think – no, see, here's the difference, because some people, what they do is, for whatever shit reason, they get to become a conduit, and then they recognize that they're a conduit, and then what they start doing is they start monetizing this very simple bit of information that they've figured out. Because there is one really simple thing that you can figure out, and the simple – and there's a lot of different ways to say it. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it's a very simple thing. I think it's a very simple thing, and there's different sentences. It can be described in a sentence, you know, which is like the most simple way to say it is all one. Mm-hmm. We're all one thing.
Right.
So that's the fractal that you can unfold and unfold and unfold. Mm-hmm. And if you unfold that, you've got every religion and every philosophy and everything unfolded in there. But some charismatic assholes, they really figure that shit out. And then instead of just like giving that idea away as well as they can, they try to turn it into a system. That's when you start getting this system of...
Doesn't that seem obvious though when it's happening? I feel like it's all about intention, the thing across the board.
Yes.
And even the concept of monetizing it. We both have podcast sponsors. There's nothing wrong with monetizing something as long as it's all done ethically and it's all done in the right mindset. And I think that...
Yeah, but
it's not about taking advantage of being a conduit. It's not about that. But it is that once you are a conduit, you know what is your obligation? Your obligation is just to be you. And if when you sell things on your podcast, sell things that you actually enjoy. And there's nothing wrong with that. The idea of business and making money always being a source of evil. Not necessarily. Just like love is not a source of jealousy. It doesn't have to be. Business can be done ethically. If someone has a fruit stand and they grow fruit and they sell it at a reasonable rate, and that's what feeds their family, there's no greed there.
No, I wasn't thinking about that.
I know you weren't. You weren't. But it becomes this thing that people love to say. They always love to equate. And then this guy just starts making money off of it. The idea of making money is always somehow connected with an erosion of ethics. With an erosion of respect for the connection that you have with other people, that you shouldn't be allowed to make money, or that someone, if they do make money, will turn to the dark side. I mean, I don't buy that, just like I don't buy all the other assumptions that we lay. If you leave a man with a woman, he'll rape her. You know, you leave a woman with your money, she'll spend it. You know, no, there's people that are – you don't have to clarify.
Okay.
I just need
to. No, I don't have to clarify for you, but for the audience, I want to clarify by saying – I'm talking about the systems of religion where you have to like you come into the religion, and there is going to be over the course of your lifetime within the religion all these varying costs that you have to pay. I mean, there's literally like religions like Scientology, for example, that have tiers of learning where you have
to pay. I'm uncomfortable because now you're equating what I do with a religion. My Twitter handle is a religion.
Listen to this, Mr. fucking start a compound.
Listen, with friends.
That was me.
I'm ready to go.
You know,
let's talk after the show.
Two times in my life, there have been two times in my life where people have told me to shave my head and move into a compound. The first time was when I was hanging out with the Hare Krishnas. The second time was when I was hanging out with you.
Well, you had taken Rogaine, and I was like, take it from a guy who's got a fucking hair transplant scar. Shave your fucking head, man. It's nonsense. You will be so free once you shave your head.
Whatever.
You
know reasons, reasons.
It's not a reason.
It's the same form. Shave your head.
Well, I went further. I went further than you. I went way out. I took the hair from the back of my head and had them take a strip of it and put it in the front. I'm giving you advice.
Words. All is temporary.
I think all
you don't
men,
need Rogaine.
I stopped.
Take it from Rogaine. No Rogaine. I think all men in their 20s should shave their heads.
Seriously. Smart.
No, they should. Like when you turn 25 or whatever, every man shaves his head. That way that you won't worry about getting bald later. Like yeah. You've seen it. It's not that bad.
And
it's
after fine. You shave your head, go to the airport and give people carnations. I got to pee. I'll be right back. Do you guys want more beers?
Yeah, sure, okay. Sure. Keep it coming.
I'm good. I'm good. With
okay, cool.
Pussy.
are we pausing this? Or
no,
talk
no,
about
no,
Duncan?
No. Let's keep going, man. Let's definitely talk all about right. Duncan. He's such a unique mix of so many different things.
How long have you known each other?
I want more than 10 years for sure. Wow. I'm not sure when we actually met. It was somewhere, I think, in the early 2000s, whenever he started working at the Comedy Store.
Right.
Just fucking. It's so important, man, to find people like that, find cool people, and then yeah. Be close to them. Like that, yeah. That changes life more than anything.
You know, you're an unusual guy in that respect. I know a lot of alpha males, and you're like, you're this alpha male guy who isn't, you know, ostensibly, I'm not saying that's your trip, right? But like that you love. And yeah. Most alpha male guys, it's about dominance. It's about maintaining some sort of hierarchy. And, you know, you're not into that trip. I noticed that about Aubrey as well. I met him last week.
Yeah.
He's also a friend of yours. And I could see why. You know, it's like, yeah, it's cool to not have that shit get in the way. But it's unusual.
Aubrey's exactly like that. He's my brother. I love that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I think that that's a huge mistake that people make. There's a weakness that they disguise as strength.
Right.
And that's it. Not being loving. Not being nice. Yeah. If the best times in life are the loving times.
Right.
Like, the conflict makes you who you are, but I feel like you should do voluntary conflict in order to work all that stuff out. Like, my real conflict in life, not so much. I mean, I had some issues. My parents got divorced. My stepdad was a young guy, and, you know, the whole thing was weird. I was 7 years old. We moved from place to place. But my conflicts are very minor in retrospect. I mean, if you really, really reflect on it honestly, my parents were very nice. My stepfather's a great, educated guy. Mm-hmm. You know, my issues were very small. No one abused me. No one beat me up. Like, I got away pretty light. But I found conflict in martial arts and in competition to be a massive part of figuring out what makes me scared, what makes me puff my chest up, what makes me loud, what makes me angry, what makes me insecure. And most of it is uncertainty, you know, an uncertainty about my health, my safety, my future, all these right. different things. And I found that in the idea of physical physical hand-to-hand, one-on-one combat, that you face the most terrifying thing that for a lot of men ever on a regular basis. And then through that, you can see who you really are. Through that, you can find your character. And I started getting into Musashi, Miyamoto Musashi, the Book of Five Rings. And the Book of Five Rings, I actually have it tattooed. My whole right arm is Musashi. Fighting a tiger.
First line of that book. Do you have that first? You know, can you say the first line of that book?
Oh God, I don't remember it.
First line of the book. My name is Miyamoto Musashi. How do you say his name?
Musashi.
My name is Miyamoto Musashi, and I have killed 76 men.
Yeah,
that's the first line of the fucking book.
That's right.
I have killed 76 men. Wow, that's like way bigger than Dahmer.
With swords. But he was also a philosopher. He was also a poet. He was also an artist. And he believed that it was very important that you be incredibly well-rounded, that you be artistic and that you be open, that you not have this ego hanging over your shoulders, weighing down your performance because you put so much weight on your performance being your entire identity. So through martial arts, I realized that's what my fear was. That's what all the chest puffing stuff was. That's what all the aggression stuff was. It was all just fear and insecurity. And in overcoming that fear and insecurity personally,
it became much easier to just be really friendly and just really nice to people.
So
and
where does stand-up fit into that?
It's just fun. It's fun. It's expressive. It's a great art form. It's, to me, the most fun thing I like to do as far as an audience member. If I like to go see some stand-up, if I knew that Duncan and Joey and Ari were performing somewhere and I could sit in the audience and watch, I'd be like, oh, this is going to be great. This is going to be a fun time. It's fun.
But is it also, especially in the early days, about confronting fear and failure?
Yeah, well, that you've confronted whether you wanted to or not. I don't think I consciously went into stand-up thinking it was going to be that scary. I don't think I had any fucking idea until I was so scared the first time I went on stage. I was shitting my pants. I was ready to chicken out, man. I was totally ready to bail.
Was it an open mic night or something?
I thought I was a badass. I was really confused. I thought I was like, I'm a national Taekwondo competitor.
Right.
You know, I won the fucking U.S. Open. I'm not scared of talking on stage.
Right. Well, this is where I'm going with that. Because like you, I can't – there may be others, but I can't think of another comic who's also physically intimidating. Because generally, they learn to be funny as a defense, right?
Yeah, well, I did too.
In high school
my sense of humor completely came out of being with a bunch of people that were about to go fight and they were terrified. And I needed to be the guy that broke up the monotony. I was the guy who made fun. So we would be on the bus and we would be traveling to a tournament and people would be scared. I've seen several of my friends get knocked unconscious with head kicks.
Right.
Good people that I really cared about. And we were competing, and some of us were in over our heads. You know, I've seen several of my friends get knocked out. Good friends that I love to death. And it was scary. So I would be the guy that would break everybody up. I would just do impressions of my instructor having sex with female students and rude, disrespectful shit that I would never admit back then.
No, man, but you've got a deeper thing than that, man. You know, comics have a deeper thing than that. It wasn't just like in the van. It's like, I hope this is okay to talk about, but I remember one thing you told me about when you were a kid going to do magic tricks on the pier. And
yeah.
Where was that?
San Francisco.
And how your parents would just let you wander off to go do magic tricks on the pier? Yeah. Comics come from strange families, man, but the idea of little young baby Rogan doing magic tricks out, you had the bug for your whole life, man.
Well, I didn't get enough attention. That's what it was. And I found that I could get attention doing that as a kid, do the magic tricks, and then as a fighter, I could get attention. I realized that I felt like between those two times, it was like I got attention through my artwork. I was I wanted to be a comic book artist. And then when I started doing martial arts, I realized that I had an outlet for all this aggression inside of me, this built-up frustration and anger, that I had a very unusual outlet. And this was an outlet that would allow me to just blow it all out in training and would literally be free of it for the first time in my life. Mm. And when I talked to my parents about it, they're like, you changed. You became a totally different person. You were this weird, scary kid up until you were 14. Just a scary, weird kid that's, you know, I mean, I was always just way quicker to want to punch somebody in the face, way quicker to get the fuck, you know, away from things if they didn't seem good. I'm like, fuck this, I'm out of here. I was the guy that was like acting on, I was convinced that the world was out to get you. I was convinced that no one was there to protect me, and I was very hostile to any aggression or any weirdness. And then doing martial arts, I completely relaxed.
See, man, that thing that you just said, this is why compassion is so important, because you'll encounter somebody right now who's like that, right now, who's like, you know, all defense mechanisms, and if you let your ego take control, you'll be a dick to that person. You'll try to punish them, you'll try to hurt them, or you'll try to get away from them, not realizing that you're just seeing like a precursor to something that could turn into an amazing being, an amazing, amazing being. You know, you know, there's all these like sweet stories people tell about the time that they were nice to somebody. And there's this thing I've been trying to write, and I was right. I'm going to tell a really quick story, this thing that happened to me about why compassion is so important. When I was in high school, I just didn't pay attention, and I like had shitty grades, and I didn't care about high school. And so I was in remedial. I was like in the 11th grade, or I was senior maybe, and I was in algebra with 10th graders because I was doing that bad. I just hated high school. And there was this like there was a bully in the class, but he was a bully in the 10th grade, and I was a senior, and he was bullying some. He was always bullying. He's bullying some kid. And at the end of class, I grabbed him. It's not fair. I'm like 2 years. I mean, I'm bigger than him. I grabbed him. I pushed him against the wall. I'm like, you just leave him alone. Just fucking leave him alone, you shithead. And like, you know, I walked out of there feeling like a hero. Like, yeah, I really let this bully have it. And so then the next day I'm at school and there's this everyone's being weird and shit. That kid that afternoon went home and shot himself. And
Duncan, I always know when you're lying.
I'm not lying. I swear to God.
Come on.
I swear on my mom.
Really?
Yeah. That kid went home and shot himself. He went into the bathroom and he put a shotgun in his mouth and he blew his brains out. Now,
what?
Yes. And he wrote a letter. You know, the letter was, there were other things going on. It wasn't that he wrote this letter like this idiot senior like shoved me in a wall and said, don't be a bully. But if there was a scale and on one side of the scale was suicide and one side of the scale was life. And marbles were dropping on those different sides of the scale. I dropped on the suicide part of that scale for sure that day.
Wow.
And I was one of the last experiences that kid had. So I was in high school. I didn't have – no one had taught me about compassion. I'd probably heard the word three times and thought it was a stupid word anyway. So, you know, you hear these stories all the time of like – I was the sweet person and the kid like didn't commit suicide. So this is why it's so important to be compassionate to people, because you have to recognize that when I was a kid, I was doing this black and white thing and I had turned this guy who was just this lanky, angry kid. I turned him into a villain. This is a villain. He's a bully and he deserves to be punished for the way he's acting. When the reality is that kid was suffering so much in his life that he decided to commit suicide because of the level of suffering that he was experiencing. So when you're around a douchebag, you really are just around somebody who's having a not great life. Mm-hmm. You're not around a villain. You're around a person who's deeply suffering. And your attempt at justice and your attempt to like right the wrong and teach him a lesson, that doesn't work.
Right.
It doesn't work.
It's like the war on poverty, the war on this,
yes,
the war on that.
It's just the amount of damage that the bully can do is so catastrophic that the people who have been bullied by the bully are like, good, fuck him. That guy ruined my life. Now he's gone. Now the dragon's been slain.
Yeah. But
they, in my opinion, are more important than the bully. And the bully, if he's going to shoot himself because you told him he was a cunt, okay, I'm sorry he's in that position. But I am far more concerned that you saved that little kid from that big asshole.
That's a sweet thing
to say.
That's
the justice in the universe. You didn't do a bad thing, man. You shouldn't be down on it. You even looking at me like the way you look when you're telling a joke, which is why I said, Duncan, and I know when you're lying.
No, it's because
he will do that to you. He will say, and that boy visits me every night in my dreams.
I used to fuck his mouth.
Like,
no, I feel guilty about that now.
No, you should not feel guilty about that, because I think that what had happened is that kid had escalated into a very bad space of physical violence. And you're not talking about a philosopher. You're talking about a 15-year-old kid, okay? And that 15-year-old kid does not recognize esoteric ideas or really abstract concepts or you preaching about compassion, you fucking 17-year-old weirdo. What they understand is you slamming them up against the locker and say, hey, fuckhead, cut this shit. Unless you can invest a massive amount of time.
You invest the time.
Oh, Jesus, you don't. You never have a light time for yourself.
No, man, you invest. Listen.
Kill bullies.
Invest the time.
Say.
No, Joe. Do not kill bullies. Love bullies. Listen, it's more effective. Trust me.
If bullies know you'll kill them, they'll just be like the future Bradley Mannings.
Listen,
they'll know that they're going to get stuck in that 24-hour surveillance.
No, Bradley Manning got bullied a lot.
If being a shithead to people fixed them, we would be in paradise.
No, you're right. You're right.
That's
being a shithead does not fix them, but the only way to have peace on Earth is to kill shitheads. So then once we kill shitheads, there will be no
shitheads.
I'm joking. Come on, you know me.
There's a great story told by one of the early American Aikido students who was in Japan studying Aikido. This is like in the 60s or something. I know you think Aikido is probably a bullshit martial art.
No, I don't. No, I don't. It's not that it's not practical.
I mean, it's not. I don't think it's great for street fighting or something. But what Aikido is really great with is conceptualizing conflict in a way that allows you to neutralize the conflict without getting into a dominant, submissive kind of hierarchical bullshit thing.
How's that? How's that?
Well, because the idea, the central idea of Aikido is to end the conflict without hurting anybody.
That's impossible.
Well, it's not.
How is that possible?
That's the beauty of Aikido. Well, one of the stories that's told by this American guy, you can find
it on the subway. I love it. Yes.
Yeah. So the guy's on the subway. He's training. He's big. He's strong.
Ancient story took place on a subway?
Yeah. It's recent. It's in like the 60s, right?
They used to have subways.
With
horses.
So he's on the subway, and this dude gets on who's drunk and belligerent and starts screaming and like raising hell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the big, strong American guy's checking him out, like, I could take this guy for sure. If things get weird, I'll step in, right? And then the guy starts he goes over to these girls who are sitting there. I may be misremembering details or whatever, but he starts screaming at these girls and really getting threatening with these girls. And the American guy's like, all right, fuck it, I'm going to – and so just as he's like getting up from the thing, he hears an old guy go, hey, like he just discovered something. Not hey, but hey. And the drunk guy looks at him, and it's this old guy, and he says, do you like sake? And the guy's like, yeah, what do you care? Oh, my wife and I used to drink a lot of sake. It's great on an afternoon to drink a little sake and the sun's going down. And he starts lulling this guy in with the, you know, I'm with you. I get you. I know. And within 5 minutes, the drunk guy's like got his head on his lap crying.
No, the way I heard the story is the drunk guy says to him, he's like, the old guy's like, you know, me and my wife drink sake. And the old guy asks him, do you have a wife? And the guy's like, my wife died.
Oh, that's right.
My wife died 2 months ago. And then the guy like sits down next to him and starts crying.
Right.
And that's why he's being a fucking belligerent shithead, because he's crazy because his heart's been just cracked open by life.
And he's angry.
It is possible.
And that's how you resolve conflict without anyone getting hurt. Yeah.
But that's not Aikido. What Aikido was created for was to disarm swords.
Well,
people
that's
have swords.
That's why. Because the other guy's got a sword, you don't. Mm. So that's why when the sword's
the
coming
extreme
at you,
version.
You don't block it. You step out of the way and you give him that trajectory. And so you use – I first heard about Aikido from a professor of mine in grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and studied with his teacher. And so the whole point is you don't meet that aggression with your own blocking aggression, because you'll get your arm cut off.
Right.
So you give him that. So if somebody comes at – like when I'm doing a public speaking gig or something and somebody comes at me with a question afterwards saying, you know, you think you know what you're talking about, but you don't know shit about genetics, man. You know, and you've mm-hmm. completely misrepresented – I give him that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, okay, you're right. Yeah, I haven't studied genetics nearly as deeply as you have. But, you know, if what you say is true, which it probably is, there's still this evidence from the, you know, and just swing it around. So, like, give him that swing. You're not going to block that sword.
Don't jump right into a conflict. So, Aikido in conversation as well. Yeah, jiu-jitsu would be a more apt term, because Aikido is really just for one aggressive assault that you have to disarm. Mm-hmm. The idea being that the guy is a weapon. Jiu-jitsu is all about never meeting things head on. When someone's coming at you, you back up. Resisting you, follow through.
And you always stay in your own point of center.
Well, it's all about, you know, look, there's two schools of thought when it comes to grappling. You know, there's the take him down, smash him, hold on to him. And the jiu-jitsu thought is if he wants to go left, you go right. If he wants to go right, you go left. If he thinks you're going to take his back, mount him. If he thinks you're going to mount him, attack his legs.
Wow.
It's like you're always moving in a lot of misdirection, a lot of technique. Jiu-jitsu is without a doubt the most technical martial art. There's so many techniques and different ways that your body can move that the difference between, say, an attacking martial art, there's variations in the way to deliver a punch or a kick or something like that, but the amount of variations is incredibly small in comparison to the amount of variables you achieve when you're grappling. Because when you're grappling, you don't have to worry about balance, or you don't have to be standing up on one leg or two legs. Like, you're moving around like fucking snakes and wrapping each other up and trying to counter techniques and trying to get a guy to think that you're countering it so you can set something else up and get him to overcommit so that you can compromise sit parts of his body.
See, what you just described, man, so many people don't understand that. And like, you know, when I tell people, like, I like to watch the UFC. I like watching fighting. And the reason I like it is because I'm friends with you and you've described it to me in that way. But a lot of people, when they see it, they don't realize that they're looking at this intellectual chess game that's sort of merged with this physical combat. Mm. That's what's cool to me is that what most people don't realize that. They just think, oh, look at dude's wrestling, man. This guy's ass in his face.
No, there's just, it's knowledge and discipline. Those are the two most important parts. Knowledge is first, discipline is second. Then the knowledge to understand what's coming up next and to intellectualize it and to have it already prepared in your database. If a guy goes this way, you know what to do. If a guy overcommits to the Kimura, you go to the Fireside Armbar. It's like this part of your brain that's just been conditioned. So that's the number one thing. And then the discipline of fucking showing up and getting in shape and getting your body does not want to get into a position where it can roll with a grown man hard for 5 minutes. It doesn't want to do that. And the only way it can do that is you got to force it. You got to tell it, listen, bitch, I don't give a fuck if you're lazy. You're going to take these 70-pound balls of iron. You're going to fucking swing them around and do presses. You're going to do all these things so that you develop this body that can do weird shit that other people can't do. And if you don't do that, you're going to get strangled. What do you want to do? You want to get strangled? No. Okay, get back in there. And only by doing that, this force of will and focus, that's the only way you can become successful.
Do you ever feel in daily life, not when you're working out or sparring or something, do you ever feel like you're walking around with a weapon?
No. I feel like I'm happy that I'm not weak. You know, I feel like if some weird shit goes down and some drunk asshole, you know, it comes to attack me, that I know instantly what to do. That it becomes it's conflict to me, like physical conflict, is a huge part of my life. Like it's been a part of my life since I was a teenager, a young teenage boy.
But does I've been that doing make something. You, do you think on any level that makes you seek it?
No.
No way. I've seen you I saw Joe at the Comedy Store. It was really cool, man. I remember knowing Rogan and having been around him and gone on tour with him, I've seen him I remember once you were doing some kicks or you were training with some kickboxing trainer and you're doing kicks. And then at the end of training with these kicks, you take the pads off and your fucking legs are bleeding.
Shins are bleeding.
Your shins were fucking – his shins are bleeding because that's how hard he kicks. You see him kick and the guy who's this trainer is you watch these ripples going through the poor bastard who's doing the training. So Joe knows how to – Joe is clearly a disciplined, trained fighter. But I remember once at the Comedy Store. I don't remember what happened, man. You were talking to some girl and she got weird. I don't remember what it was, but she brings back her boyfriend. And it was clearly a situation – where you could have easily, if you had been an asshole and wanted to, prove that you could fight or your ego was caught up in it, you could have easily, this would have been probably a pretty bloody, bad situation for that guy. And I remember watching, I wonder what the fuck's gonna happen here. Is he gonna, fight? And then you totally diffused it. It was there was no ego. You just said exactly the right things to make the guy not feel like he had to be aggressive, and then he walked away with his girlfriend and it was over.
I remember what you're talking about. That guy did not want to fight. He got in a bad situation where he had a bad, drunk, abusive girlfriend and she was causing problems. And I think he was pretty aware of it.
But that's what a martial artist does. Yeah. Because a guy.
He and I had a sort of almost instant understanding. I remember that. He came over and he's like, hey man, what happened? And I was like, look, dude, I'm trying to be nice. She's just drunk and all due respect. You know, I just got to get her out of here, brother. You know,
but dumb-dumbs don't do that.
The guy in his case, he was cool.
Right.
He, you know, is you could get in a situation where you have to defend yourself. It's unfortunate.
Of course.
The reason I asked that, there was a brief period in my life when I carried a pistol.
Last week.
What period was that?
The meth period.
Yeah, I was going to say, you beat me to it. God damn it.
Yeah, these aren't my original teeth. No, and it was weird because when I had it, I changed the way I saw things, you know, and I was looking for – not that I was looking to shoot anybody, but I was just aware of the fact that I got this pistol. And it just changed – I mean, I was living in New York. I was riding the subway. You know, there's all this – it was a weird thing. I had to have it legally. I mean, I had codes to a vault with about $1 billion worth of – goods in it, and I worked in the diamond district at the time.
Wow, that's incredible.
Weird time in my life. So the insurance company, since I had the code, required that I had this pistol, and so it was just weird. It was really weird to
you were illegally carrying the pistol. You didn't have a concealed legally. Okay.
Yeah, Eddie Bravo had that situation happen to him. You know, Eddie Bravo to this day, when he goes into Canada, they harass him.
not harass him, but they give him extra questions because he was working for a check cashing company and he would carry a giant amount of cash to another place. Mm. And as he was on his way, he got pulled over and the cops come up to him. You are legally required to say, I have a loaded firearm. Here's my permit. This is my job. And so they take him out of the car. They handcuff him. They check all his credentials and then they let him go. And even though there was no charge, every time he goes into Canada, they're like, what happened to you? Well, you got arrested for having a gun. And it's like, well, I got arrested, but I was allowed to have the gun. Well, then why'd they arrest you? Well, I was working at a check cashing place. Do you have any proof that you're working at? You know, and it's like he has to go through this whole hour process. So if I go to Canada with him, like when he was working for the UFC, I'll be like, good luck, bitch. I'm not going through that thing with you. They're going to bring me in that room too, man. I had to go in that room with him twice. You sit in that room and they fucking ask you questions.
I've been like, in that room.
Comedy. I'm here for comedy. I tell jokes.
Room sucks, man. And you get pulled into that room a lot more coming into the U.S. than going out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah.
What's with Ari and the TSA thing?
He gets crazy. Ari gets crazy. I'm going to pee. You guys talk about Ari.
Well, Ari and Brendan Walsh have very strong opinions about the TSA, and they're activists, basically.
But, I mean, is it performance art on some level?
No.
No.
No, I think it's the, you know, comedians have a very, they tend to have a anti-authority perspective. Sure. And so he bristles under the idea that he has to, like, he's obviously not a terrorist. He's clearly no threat to anything. The TSA, we all know by now that the TSA misses stuff coming in all the time. They're right. Not like really that effective at all. It seems to just be a way for people to make money. It's a way
security
to
security theater.
Yes. Yeah. That's amazing. Security theater. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. So my opinion with it is I'm usually in a hurry or I just want to get through. And I know that's a shitty way to look at it, but I'm not aggressive with them.
Well,
they're
doing a job. They're getting $12 an hour. Right? I mean, the guy – this is the problem with civilization, one of the many problems, is that the guy who you're talking to, he's just doing his fucking job.
Right.
Right? He's not the guy who passed the law or decides what they're looking for or who they're pulling over. Right? He's just some dude with a low-level job.
Well, isn't that the story of fascism, though? Isn't
sure,
that
it's the story of everything. Yeah,
it's like – so it's like it's the diffusion of responsibility.
Right.
And it's like there's no way that you're going to get to the top of the pyramid with the guy who's like pulling the strings. So if you really – the idea is like make it so it's not so easy for the people at the bottom of the pyramid and then maybe that will cause change. Mm. I think Ari – of all my friends, Ari is at the very top of the list of my friends who I know is going to get arrested, and it's going to be because of what he's doing. Or Ari's your friend who, like, when the shit really hits the fan and Alex Jones is right and the new world order happens, Ari is the one who's the first to get marched behind the house and shot in the face. Definitely.
Sorry.
He wouldn't be able to keep his mouth shut.
He doesn't keep his mouth shut.
He wouldn't be
Well, I admire that in a lot of ways
because
he's not doing it from a position of power.
Yeah.
He's just doing it from a logical argument. You know, he's like, well, why? Why can you tell me what to do? Why? We didn't ask for this. Like, this isn't the law. This is crazy. Like, you're just a person. You can't search my bag twice. I was there with him when the guy told him that he was going to search his bag twice. And it was fascinating watching Ari react to it. Because he was like, come on, let's just go. Come on. You see I'm not a threat. Let me through. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, you want to talk to me like that? I'll search your bag again. He goes, you don't just get to search my bag again. And he's like, "What? Why do you get to search my bag again? You searched my bag. Give me my fucking bag.
And he said, give me my fucking bag?
He farted in front of this guy. Okay? The guy's like, you do have to listen to me. And Ari farts loudly. He goes, you got to smell my fart. He goes, go ahead, smell my fart. Like, I mean, he's like standing right
what
next to the guy.
What did the guy do?
The guy might have even thought he was on a TV show because the way Ari was doing it was so over the top. And I'm behind Ari laughing. I had already gone through. Okay, Ari won't take his shoes off. They tell him, take his shoes off. Sorry, he goes, medical condition. That's how he says it. Medical condition. No, I'm not taking my shoes off. So because he won't take his shoes off, they have to search him. So they pat him down, and they have to pat him down. He's like, come on, just go. Hurry up. Hurry up. Come on, move. And he taunts him the whole way.
Wow.
And the guy goes, I'm going to bring my – this is another time in Vegas. He goes, I'm going to bring my supervisor over here. He goes, oh, great, another idiot? Is he the king of the idiots?
Wow.
Yeah, bring him over. And he goes, hey, idiot.
What are you going to do? Are you going to tell me I have to take my fucking shoes off too? Let me go. I'm late. I'm going home. And then, you know, they fucking freak out and they don't know what to do. But ultimately, what's revealed in this is that they're not cops. And they aren't just employees.
They have to let
and,
him go.
And Ari is right. They searched him. They did search him. He goes, I don't have to be nice to you. He goes, get a better job. He goes, what you're doing is bullshit. He goes, you're fucking enslaving people. You're stealing and you're enslaving people. It's fascinating.
Wow.
He doesn't give a fuck.
Ari's a cool guy, man. What a cool freak.
He's an interesting dude.
He's a loon.
Well, he's very confident now, too, because he's finally independent.
He's been through it.
Yeah. He's also independent.
Is he coming back to L.A.?
He's going to be here for a few months. We're doing some gigs. What are we doing? We're doing Chicago Theater, January 21st.
Polar Vortex. 24th.
Yeah, maybe. Hopefully, by the time we get there, global warming will have firmly kicked in. I feel that this whole polar vortex is really just the Illuminati getting together to get us to ignore global warming.
You know what, man? Somebody tweeted this to me, and I love it. They showed that meteor that shot over Russia. Did you see that?
No.
So it's a tweet.
I saw the meteor, but I didn't see the tweet.
They tweeted a picture of the meteor flying over Russia. And, you know, with the trails behind it. And they're like, the meteor is dispensing chemtrails.
Yeah, it's the Illuminati, brother.
It's really cool, though, when you see a thing that's inarguably a natural object entering the Earth's atmosphere, and the exact same trails are coming off of it are coming off of, like, planes that the chemtrail freaks are. You got in a lot of trouble about that, man. It's really funny.
It's not trouble. It's foolish people that are uneducated. It's really simple. It's really unfortunate, but it's really simple. And if people
Do you know
have-
about this?
Well, I know that – I didn't see that episode of the show.
So Joe – there's a chemtrail episode, and Joe came out against chemtrails. He doesn't believe that chemtrails are happening. He says that those are contrails. I agree with you. I don't believe that either. I think it's a bunch of bullshit, and I think it's in the same school of thought with the people – the idea that the fucking Boston bombings, those are actors.
Yeah.
What's that called, those actors? It's called something actors. What's it called?
Yeah, we talked about it right before. Conflict actors.
Conflict actors. But, like, you know about this, right? The conflict actor thing?
Mm.
So basically these lunatics say that the Boston bombing is actors – who are pretending to be hurt, and they do these disgusting, gruesome.
The victims.
Yeah, the victims. Oh. They do these gruesome diagrams where, like, they show in one of these diagrams, it's a guy who just had his leg blown off.
Yeah.
You see his fucking femur poking out, you see the white bone. Blood is not gouting out at this very second. I don't know why. I'm not a doctor. Blood isn't gouting at that moment.
It comes out in heartbeats and spurts. So if the photo was taken in the diastolic stage, there wouldn't be any spurt.
Right. Exactly. They don't know that. So they're like, look, fake bone, no blood. And then – so now they're – so it's not just bad enough that when you finally ran a marathon – probably, like, have been training for years to do this marathon.
That's the mind of a comic. Start with the training.
You finally run a marathon.
Yep.
I think about me. I've been bragging to my friends for months. I'm going to do this marathon. I've been jogging, guys. I'm finally getting my shit together. Your first marathon, you end up looking down at your femur because your leg got blown off by a fucking psychopath, right? That's the worst.
Yeah.
That's already hell.
That's pretty bad.
Now let's add to it.
Yeah.
Now the picture of you staring down in shock, your femur poking out, is being distributed by lunatic idiot. I don't even want to call them lunatics. They don't even deserve to be called lunatics because they're fucking not lunatics. They're just morons. Like, they're not even like lunatics. There's something glorious about a lunatic. Free, wild, roaming the world, out of his mind. These are just dumbasses, like paranoid dopes. Now your picture is being distributed by paranoid fucking dopes.
But the tragedy of it, like the guy who doubted Natasha's thing, you know, and thought it was all. The tragedy of it is that there's a germ in there that I actually admire. The germ of saying I don't believe what I'm told just because it comes across the media.
Yeah, well,
we all admire that. Right. We're all critical thinkers.
How about just learn the word diastolic? How about this? You fucking learn the word diastolic and then put your fucking shit pictures up there, asshole, because they don't know it. And by the way, these pictures, they'll have a picture of like. People tend to look the same. If I take a blurry picture of a person and put it next to another person, they look kind of the same. Mm. Enough where you're like, well, they do kind of look the same.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they're the fucking same.
Right.
If you really want to do it, Like, if you really believe this is happening, like, there's these I can't remember what they call them. Drama. I can't remember the name of the actors.
Conflict actors.
Conflict actors. Here's what you need to do. Fuck face. Go.
It's like the fourth time you haven't remembered the phrase conflict actors.
It's infuriating. It's infuriating.
Are you having some kind of embolism here?
No. I don't know why this really.
It's awesome.
It really pisses me off.
Embrace it.
It really pisses me off.
Yes.
Go. If you really believe this, and the world doesn't believe it, you need to make the pilgrimage to the home of the person whose children were murdered. And you need to go make sure that they're there. And then you need to go find the person that you think looks like them. You have to prove this for real, not just by taking shitty internet JPEGs and posting them up on Twitter. You need to fucking investigate, cocksucker, because if you really believe – if this is really happening, it's your – moral responsibility to not do lazy research and just tweet some shit picture. You've got to go deep, man.
Right. But don't you think it's your responsibility to treat him with the same compassion that you wish you treated that bully? Don't you think it's your responsibility to take him and use the seeds of what Chris Ryan said?
Thank you.
And use the seeds of what Chris Ryan said is that there is something there that I admire.
Thank you, Joe.
The fact that they're not willing to just trust.
Thank you.
What the state-run media is telling them.
This is why you need friends.
Well, I have really good friends, unfortunately, that believe some of the things I rally against about chemtrails, like me and Eddie Bravo and chemtrails. Look, I love Eddie Bravo to death. That guy is my brother. I love him.
Yeah.
I respect him. He's a fucking awesome human being.
Yes.
But he and I disagree about the chemtrail issue. And I think his heart is in the right place. I think he really wants to make sure that we live in a safe world. And he rightly doesn't trust the government. We just disagree about the methodology, and we disagree about the – there's the problem with the chemtrail thing, and this is one of the things that I got in trouble with all these people, is that there's a real science – to the whole idea about chemtrails. Your dog scratching at the door?
No, I just opened it.
Oh, yes. Want some air?
Yeah. We're in a cloud of frankincense and myrrh in here.
There's a real – Duncan's lighting incense. There's a real science behind it, unfortunately. When you burn jet fuel, which is what a jet engine does, it changes the atmosphere. When you're driving or you're flying rather through a hazy, cloudy, like semi-cloudy night or day – and either one, when you're going through those clouds and the jet engine burns jet fuel, it creates moisture and literally creates a cloud.
Right.
It absolutely does create a cloud. Just like when you watch like these a bunch of videos that people are doing on YouTube because of this polar vortex that they're talking about.
Yes.
Have you seen the Super Soaker?
No.
Oh, they spray it. Yeah.
Amazing.
The boiling water. They
41
spray it.
Below zero in Winnipeg. So these guys took a super soaker filled with boiling water and they shot it into the air. You know what happened? Clouds.
Right.
Looks like chemtrails. It looks like clouds. Clouds are not like a super complicated thing. And this idea that these are aluminum and barium. Like I had Roseanne Barr on my podcast last week and she started spouting off about chemtrails and they were spraying aluminum in the air. And I explained to her, like, there was a guy who did a documentary on these things, and it's called What in the World Are They Spraying? And he had this analysis of this water, and the water showed that it was X percent aluminum. And I said to him, I said, well, okay, this water that you had tested, why does it say sludge? It says sludge. And the guy says, well, I don't know, it was water. I said, but did the water have dirt in it? I don't think it did have dirt in it. Well, it says sludge.
Yeah.
If it's sludge, that means the lab saw dirt in it. Do you know what percentage of aluminum is in dirt?
At the bottom of a river.
Yeah. Everywhere. The aluminum's everywhere.
Yeah.
So what you have is dirt that tested positive for being dirt, and you're using that to say that this is why I can prove to you that chemtrails are real. If you did see aluminum being sprayed out of a plane, first of all, do you know how much fucking aluminum you would have to spray out of a plane to make clouds that go across the city? It would take millions of pounds of this shit. You wouldn't even be able to fit it in a fucking plane. If you blew aluminum out of a jet, it would literally it would be the exact dimensions of the jet in aluminum powder. That's it. If you stuffed it to the back of the fucking pilot's head, you don't have much room for aluminum, fuckhead.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you're flying around spraying aluminum, that shit's gonna run dry real quick. These guys are making clouds with a jet engine.
Yeah.
That's it. And the real concern is not that. The real concern is
We are getting accustomed to the idea of burning jet fuel in the sky all day. That's the real chemtrail.
That's it.
Our fucking temperature on Earth has changed. You can observe it clearly. The 9/11, the days after 9/11 when they shut down flights, the temperature of the Earth noticeably shifted. And it shifted because we're not burning fucking jet fuel in the sky and making artificial clouds. It's not this gigantic global conspiracy to engineer the weather. No, it's a side effect of jet travel. That's it.
But here's the thing, Matt. So, I agree with you and everything you just said.
Could I just jump in?
Yes.
Not to pile on you here, but I just want to like follow up the end result of what you're suggesting, that guy go track people down. So it starts with the guy training for the marathon, right? Mm-hmm. Then he loses his legs. Then he's got people questioning whether it really happened to him. Then if people follow Duncan's advice, they show up in his front fucking yard. Knock on his door.
I don't need you to know I'm real.
Go away.
Put my fucking wheelchair down. My son's getting me home in 5 minutes. He'll fucking kill you.
Stop unwrapping my bandages. No,
I'm gonna show you my fucking scar. This is not a hologram.
This is.
I'm sorry. I just had to note that.
Don't go hunt him down.
It's perfect. That's a beautiful statement.
You're right.
That and the compassion argument. We shot Duncan right into the fucking middle of the ocean.
I deserve it too. All of my friends.
It's so close after the bully story. It's so perfect.
Now, all of my friends, Raghu Marcus from the Love Surf Remember Foundation, all my friends will inevitably, I'll talk about compassion and then I'll be in the depths of like angrily ranting and judging someone in the most furious dumb way. So I have a lot of work to do, but my point is I got to go to a lot more retreats. Probably like $100,000 worth of retreat.
First world problem.
Yeah.
My point is, so the chemtrails aren't real. No one's dropping aluminum.
But this is the thing. The real problem with calling non-chemtrails chemtrails is that if there ever was anything the government sprayed out of planes, which they have done in the past, you diminish it by crying wolf.
Disinformation.
Accidentally, inadvertently distributing disinformation.
But that's the chemtrail. What I'm trying to say is your disinformation and you spreading fear by talking about something that isn't real and infecting people with that same paranoid nonsense is the chemtrail. You're spreading poison.
Right.
You're spreading poison by talking about an illusionary thing that is not spreading poison, and you have become the fucking chemtrail.
And you make other things that are real things, you make them a joke.
You're distracting attention away from the lack of banking reform, the prison industrial complex, you know, all these things that are real.
Well, you see what's going on today, right? You see this Governor Christie thing today?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay, what is this Governor Christie thing today about? Well, it's a fucking distraction because they're about to pass a new trade bill.
Some people don't know what that is.
Okay. Governor Christie today he got in trouble because they said that there was a memo among staff members that claimed that Governor Christie had threatened to shut down various aspects of the bridge, various lanes of the bridge, and they were doing it just to like for political muscle
to punish someone
because the mayor of that town didn't endorse him for re-election,
and somebody died in an ambulance because they couldn't because of the congestion, supposedly.
Of course, of course. So this sullies his image, and this becomes a big scandal. But at the same time, the Obama administration is silently trying to pass a new trade bill that everyone is freaking out about, and people are it's congressional deal reached on Obama's trade talks authority. This is a very fascinating thing. This TPA legislation. There's a massive amount of people that are freaking out about this, and they're calling it the NDAA on steroids.
Whoa.
Yeah. They're like saying like what they're doing here is changing the way they can do business and
what
they can get away with.
It's so weird how like anytime some crazy scandal happens, that's when the shit bills go through.
Yeah, of course.
That in late Fridays. late on Fridays when you like when you come out and say, "Oh yeah, I did fuck the whore," but anyway, you know, and no one will hear
people
it.
Forget about it over the weekend.
They won't hear it.
Sorry, I have to piss again.
It's the whole thing is very strange. I'm just learning about it. A friend of mine on Twitter exposed me to it.
I just like to note for the record that I have the biggest bladder in this room.
Yeah, you hung in there tough. But it's like you get weak when there's three people, you know you can step out.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm doing a one-on-one podcast, if it's just you and me, I know I have to hang in there.
Yeah, that's right. You do them live, so you can't even hit the pause button.
Yeah, TPP is this legislation. So look into it, folks. I'm just learning about it today, and it's pretty fucking scary. It's really bizarre and fascinating stuff, but it's scary.
You ever read Howard Zinn, A People's History of the USA?
No, I haven't. I've heard it's been recommended to me, but I never got around to reading it.
It's fantastic. It's a history of the United States written from the perspective of the losers, right? Because history is always written from the perspective of white upper-class men. So this is history of the United States written from the perspective of slaves, Native Americans, and women. And it's a huge bestseller. It's been a bestseller since it came out, 15, 20 years ago. And it's interesting story about him. He was Matt Damon's next door neighbor growing up in Boston.
Wow.
And he taught at Harvard or MIT or one of the big colleges in Boston there. And Matt Damon's mother was like a single, raising him, single woman. And Mr. Zinn, who lived next door, used to take Matt to ball games and to the park. And, so he was sort of a surrogate dad for Matt Damon growing up.
That's probably why he's so fucking smart. Matt Damon's pretty interesting. I thought it was funny that that
Ben
Matt
Affleck,
Stone
too.
And Trey Parker decided to make him a complete moron on their Team America.
Team America made him a puppet. Yeah.
He was a puppet in Team America. And he could just only say Matt Damon. He was like really stupid. But he's very smart.
He's super smart. And Ben Affleck is super high IQ as well.
Matt Damon had one of the best takes on Sarah Palin. He's like, are we really going to accept that this person, are we living in a fucking comedy movie where just a salt of the earth person by circumstance gets into the White House? I mean, she's really going to be a heartbeat away from the White House. I mean, this good old-fashioned moxie, and she's going to save us from Putin. He's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And I remember him saying that. I was like, wow, that is like a movie from the 80s. Yeah.
But it is reality.
Mm-hmm.
And there are the head of the Congressional Committee on Science and Technology believes the Earth is 6,000 years old.
Mm-hmm. Stop it.
No, oh, yeah.
Yeah. More than 46% of the United States believes that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old.
Yeah,
according to a recent Gallup poll.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that because I always say this and people criticize it as my lack of understanding about science. But I believe that if you have a poll about how old the Earth is, you only have the results of people so fucking stupid they're willing to take a poll on how old the Earth is.
That's a good point.
I don't think it's 46%.
There is critical thinking.
I don't even think it's
20%.
I think you're dealing with a small percentage of fucking idiots.
Well, I saw somebody
willing to answer polls.
No, I saw you interviewing Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah.
Was he just on the show once or is he?
Yeah, just once. We're trying to work out another one. This thing is
great,
dude.
He's great.
I fucked with it,
I don't even know what it is.
No, those things get
Neil deGrasse Tyson is great.
He's fantastic. But if I remember correctly, you guys were going back and forth a little bit about the moon landing. Are you a skeptic about that?
We weren't going back and forth about it. He was kind of schooling me but he's a very, very skeptical guy. And even if it was like really ridiculous, if it wasn't absolutely confirmed scientific consensus that the moon landing was a hoax, he would never be willing to go in that direction. He's a scientific person. Me, I'm an idiot. So if I see a 1% possibility that someone faked a moon landing, I will explore it with every ounce of my being because I find it fascinating. What's really interesting about the moon landing is that not just have we not been able to go, but that we went seven times, six successfully from 1969 to 1972, and then we just stopped. And when you go back and look at the footage, it looks like horseshit. It looks fake as fuck. If you watch the interviews of the astronauts after they land, the press conference, it looks like they're lying. If you look at the actual footage of people falling down and getting up, it looks like they're on wires.
But
I don't think that the moon landing is fake. But what I do think is, first of all, if you're dealing with a situation where you're in another planet, you're in 1/6 Earth's gravity, like our conception of how a person would move and not move is probably very distorted. Like, we have no idea what it would be like to be in 1/6 gravity. It'd probably look really fucking weird and fake.
Right.
Because it's not on Earth. So our whole, like, the way we accept movement and see movement is, and recognize it in our head, it's based on our atmosphere. It's based on our gravity. It's based on the oxygen in the air. When you're on the moon, things are going to be fucking weird, you know?
Yeah.
Me, as an uneducated, unscientific person, I didn't think of that. I thought, well, this looks fake as fuck. That guy's on wires. And then there's always this automatic need to look to anything from that time as being bullshit. Like, the idea that they did accomplish something in that time. Like, look at what they did with Lee Harvey Oswald and the single bullet theory. Look what they did with the Gulf of Tonkin when they led us into Vietnam. Look what they did with Nixon and Watergate. It seemed like deception was the standard. And it seemed like the idea of them being noble and telling the truth was probably more preposterous than deception. And then if you look at Neil Armstrong's speech, his 25th anniversary, the moon landing speech, where he talks about truths that can be revealed, that under great things that can be accomplished if they can remove one of truth's hidden layers, he starts giving this really cryptic speech. Have you never heard it?
Uh-uh.
All right, I'll pull it up and I'll play it for the audience. But make no mistake about it. It's not that I used to believe that people didn't land on the moon. I used to firmly believe that. I don't believe that anymore.
The thing is, in those days, the Earth was full of telescopes that were powerful enough to watch.
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. They can't go to the moon. They can't see what's on the moon. It's really hard. It's really hard to show.
Yeah, there's no telescopic pictures of the moon landing. No one took pictures with telescopes from the Earth of the moon landing.
Well, I'm not saying optical telescopes.
Well, no, they could observe the path.
They're measuring the fucking waves coming off quasars 100 million.
Oh, yeah, now. Here, I'll play it for you. I'll play it for you because this will kind of make you freak out because it's very bizarre. And again, this is me not saying that people didn't go to the moon, but saying it's bizarre whether you believe people went to the moon or not. This is a fascinating aspect of the reality that we live in, that this is actually the speech that this guy gave at the 25th anniversary of the moon landing.
You ever see Ali G's interview with Buzz Aldrin?
Oh, you got no fucking signal here at all. Do you have Wi-Fi here, dude?
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
We're going to tell the world.
Oatmeal Maiden.
Okay, give me a second.
Oatmeal Maiden XT.
Let me get
Come
to
on
it.
Over to Duncan's I'm going to have to get Wi-Fi.
And we'll crank this back because there's no cell phone here.
Yeah,
what is your network?
I just interviewed a woman.
Oatmeal Maiden XT.
Oh, you're serious.
Oatmeal Maiden. Wow. Quaker?
I don't use it for anything else. Freedom 108.
Yeah. Change that shit.
Who's going to get into my fucking
The people, man.
Jesus Christ. That's right at the 2-hour mark. Thank God. I'll delete it.
Yeah, just delete that shit.
Or you could just change your password.
Okay, I'm
good
back.
Good point.
Freedom 109. Freedom 110. They'll never guess of that. Never guess that. I just interviewed a woman a couple days ago who's one of the first women to work in the upper echelons of NASA. And she designed the first Landsat, which is still in operation until like 2 years ago. You know, the satellite that maps the planet of the Earth, just spins around the Earth, mapping. So they could see, like, you know, that's the satellite that can, like, say, oh, look, this forest is burning, you know, or this ice cap is receding.
Cool.
That's all her stuff, her work. She's amazing.
That's wild. Yeah, some of the new technology that they have, like, have you heard about, I think I've already talked about this with you, but in Africa, how they used one of those satellites to find, like, a giant reservoir of water.
Oh, yeah. And they find in archaeology, it's amazing. They found all these road systems in the Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
It turns out that actually the Amazon was like farmed.
It was a city.
It was huge,
For a long time. Way back before they thought that people had colonized the Amazon with sophisticated farming techniques.
Yeah.
They thought that people were just hunter-gatherers exclusively. No, they had established communities and they had different paths for water, and you know, they had a lot of shit. Your Wi-Fi sucks a fat one too, buddy.
No, it doesn't. How dare you?
Well, people can just Google it, right?
I'll come up with it eventually.
Hold on, I'll get it. What's it? What?
It's just for whatever reason, it's not pulling up.
I don't know what's happening. What's the? What is it?
Oh, here it is. Here it is.
On the 25th anniversary of the event in 1994, Neil Armstrong made a rare public appearance and held back tears as he spoke these brief cryptic remarks before the next generation of taxpayers as they toured the White House.
No, this is real.
Today we have with us a group of students among America's best. To you, we say, we have only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers.
Okay, what the fuck does that mean? All right, I'm not saying that that means we didn't go to the moon, but why the fuck would you say that if you're on the 25th anniversary of NASA and you're standing in front of the greatest high school students in the country and you're trying to give them a pep speech or you're trying to explain to them what could be done in this world, what you've done? Why wouldn't you just say, I've been to the fucking moon, man? Let me tell you something.
I just want to – I would much rather him give an hour speech on truth's protective layers. What the fuck does that mean? A protective layer?
And here's the thing. People that are like, you fucking don't believe we went to the moon. You're a fucking idiot. You're a truther. That, what I just played you, is real.
Yeah.
It's real.
Okay, but
it's
you,
very strange.
I'd
it's
like
real.
To hear the rest of the context, what he said right mm-hmm. after that. I'd also like to know if truth protective layer might be a Shakespearean term or a term
that's a good
in
point.
Some other
resonance. Let me look it up right now. Let's I'd look like up truth protective
if
layer.
If he wrote that speech or someone wrote the speech.
Sounds like
for
a death
him,
metal band.
All good points. All good points. Truth. All good points.
And also, even if, you know, even like let's assume that he wrote it and it's not a Shakespearean term or whatever. You know, truth is protected by layers of ignorance, by fear. You know, it's a metaphoric term that could reflect lots of different directions. Right?
The real issue is that it's very cryptic.
Guys,
regardless of his intention, what he was trying to put out, it is undeniably cryptic.
I'm going to read where this is where I go for all my answers, and it's where you should go if you're wondering about something.
JoeRogan.net.
Yahoo Answers. What did astronaut Neil Armstrong mean when he said, there are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers? Let's look at its best answer. He also said there are places to go beyond belief. What it means is Neil Armstrong found aliens during his
there you have it.
And I wrote that. And by the way, that's how good Yahoo Answers is. I wrote that.
And he has been sworn never to speak of it. One, he was crying when he said it because he had been sworn never to speak the truth about what he knows. Two, he appears to be speaking in code, which would confirm the things he saw on the moon. Three, former chief of NASA Communications Systems Maurice Chatelain said Armstrong had indeed reported seeing two UFOs on the rim of a crater. The encounter was common knowledge in NASA. Four, places to go beyond belief equals aliens are already capable of interstellar travel because they are here. Five, breakthroughs available. Truth's protective layers. Disclosure that aliens are here. Learn the truth behind the cover-up and discover the truth about the most important discovery in all of human history. What Neil Armstrong said to Mission Control. NASA. What's there? Mission Control calling Apollo 11. Apollo 11. These babies are huge, sir. Enormous. Oh, my God. You wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you, there are other spacecraft out there lined up on the far side of the crater edge. They're on the moon watching us. Maurice Chatelain said, we were warned off the moon. Have you ever wondered why the moon missions ended? Whoa. The aliens are like, get the fuck off my property.
Just as likely as we faked the moon landing, by the way. Just as likely. All of it likely.
I like the story. I like the idea of aliens on the moon.
I like it.
And some grumpy old alien being like, one day those monkeys are going to come up here. I'm telling you.
Better get out of here. It's my yard.
The moon is their yard.
Get off my yard, you fucking hippies. John McCain.
Hippies in your spacesuit. You can't even breathe moon air.
Well,
fucking pussies.
I think that's a great way to end the podcast.
Is that it?
This has been an amazing podcast. We're not going to do guys, if you want a three-hour podcast, that's the standard for the Joe Rogan Experience. This is already twice as long as my usual podcast, but this has been awesome.
Oh, it always will be. And, you know, we should tell people what we've decided to do.
Oh, yeah. So what we're going to do is all three of us are going to start doing podcasts together, and we're just going to sort of leapfrog from each person's podcast to the next.
Yeah, I mean, we thought about doing our own, like having like a trialogue type podcast, and Duncan didn't realize trialogue means conversation between three people.
No, I thought it was something
we were copying the McKenna, Rupert Sheldrake, Ralph Abraham name, but it's actually means three people talking. What we were going to do is just start our own, but we decided, well, why would we do that? We already have like all these people that listen to our podcast, and it only help each of our podcasts individually. So we're just going to go back. So you're up next, Chris.
Well, as the baby of the group, I definitely am up for that. That's fantastic.
Well, there's no baby in the group. That's ridiculous.
The newbie.
You're very
newbie.
Nice. I'm a newbie. Well, you're more new to podcasting, but not to thinking. And that's
right.
That's what makes it all beautiful. Yeah. It's a fun way of talking. This is really
it's fantastic.
It's very unique, you know, the three of us doing it this way. I like it a lot. A lot of fun.
It's a blast.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to doing this once a month.
Chris Yahoo. Ryan, tangentially speaking, and you're at Chris Ryan on Twitter?
Chris Ryan, PhD.
Joe Rogan, the Joe Rogan Experience, at Joe Rogan, touring all the time. I'm going to start going out with him again.
Oh, yeah.
Stand-up hiatus.
You want to come this weekend? I'm in Phoenix. You want
to
come? Every show sold out.
Going to the desert.
Oh, that's right. He's going to leave a body
in the desert.
No, I'm not. You're the one who said that. I'm just going out to the desert.
Just loads. Not a body. Just come.
Oh, how dare you call it loads. These are savages I've let into my house.
Oh, I'm sorry. I disappoint again.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
I'm so happy we're friends.
Yeah, I'm happy we're friends as well.
Definitely.
Thanks for listening, you guys. That was Joe Rogan and Chris Ryan. If you like the podcast, give us a nice rating on iTunes, won't you? Bye.